South America.
Here we go. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Pike, God, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! All right, the 12th day of July, 2013. This is The Horn, headonradionetwork.com. About a minute past the hour, headonradionetwork.com being the simplest way to get the program. Just go there and click listen live. Also at headonradionetwork.com, you will find our PayPal button. That's how we keep all of this on the air. We will begin this Friday seeking to raise $265. That's what we've got to do to end the week in the black, or at least the gray. I don't think we're ever actually flush around here. But, yeah, $265, that's 26 people at 10, 13 people at 20, and my math goes no further. You can also, of course, contribute by going to headonradionetwork.com and clicking the Contribute tab, where you will find the traditional mail address. The Horn, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB 318, Beckley, West Virginia, 25801. Remember, do not make checks payable to either Bob, well, to Bob Kincaid, Bobby Decay, Bob Al Kincaida. No, no, no. Checks and money orders should be made payable to Head on communications, something like that. Because, well, it ain't my money. It's money that goes to keep this whole process going. So, there you have it. This is Friday on the front porch. The Zimmerman trial has gone to the jury. This is the part of the process that, for lawyers, is like waiting for the birth of a baby. And I don't know, we may, you never know with a jury. You don't know how long they're going to be out. But they have requested a list of the exhibits. They've been instructed. And now the waiting begins. But with that in mind, I've not spent much time at all on the Zimmerman trial, simply because it seems that the for-profit media have made it their personal province to cover it. But as Dr. John noted the other night, turning a camera on a proceeding and letting it roll is not the same thing as journalism. I saw a story earlier today that reminded me of what Dr. John had said. And not because this is the same thing, but because it's reminiscent of how little actual journalism takes place in this country anymore. A story of a young photojournalist in Egypt who actually managed to likely catch on video the moment that he himself was murdered by an Egyptian soldier, a sniper. And his grieving mother, interviewed, of course, by someone for CNN, said that he had told her, "If I die looking for truth, if I die exposing the truth, I will die happy." And somehow or another, I was immediately caused, if you will, to think about the difference between that young man and, say, I don't know, David Gregory. Or Andrea Mitchell. Or Cokie Roberts. Or, God knows, Wolf Blitzer. Pampered princes of the for-profit media and princesses who sit in, who draw massive salaries and never get anywhere near actual journalism. There is a difference. There is very little actual journalism happening in this country at this time. But at any rate, the Zimmerman trial, the coverage of the Zimmerman trial, has not been journalism either. So with the case having gone to the jury, then I thought it might actually be beneficial if we talked a little bit about the trial process in this particular instance, and generally as well. So I've called on a friend of mine. The so-called liberal community in West Virginia is, I mean, those of us who are really, really liberals, is a fairly small and merry band of brothers and sisters. And one of those people happens to be a lawyer from Charleston, West Virginia, by the name of Timothy Koontz. I've known Tim for years. And he is one humdinger of a criminal defense lawyer. He's good. He has an acquittal rate up above 95% in the more than 200 murders that he has tried in this state over the course of his 30-year career. So while there may be procedural and statutory differences between a trial in West Virginia and a trial in Florida, I think he's going to have some pretty good insights on what it is exactly that we have seen. But I want to make it clear that this is not, or I hope it will not be, the same thing as what I saw one night on Headline News or Chicken Noodle News or something like that, where you had a group of cackling pettifoggers and a so-called jury going back and forth, gleefully hashing out the day's day's events in the trial. No, I'd like to hope that this will be a conversation about how the judicial system handles such things as this when the media, who are supposed to be the fourth estate and guardians of freedom, actually turn out to be little more than profiteering information bandits. See where I'm getting at? So hopefully here in a very few minutes we will be talking with Timothy Koontz, and we'll get into the nature of the charges, how the charges came to be what they were, and the strengths and weaknesses as he understands them within the case as it was put forward both by prosecution and defense. The jury, I'm told by Dr. John, in the Zimmerman murder trial has recessed for the night. They will they will reconvene in the morning, so there will be no breathless reportage from the for-profit media this evening of the reception and waiting for a verdict. They're going to go home for a little while and sleep with their consciences and come back and begin deliberations. Juries, You ever sat on one? Juries are funny things. They can make decisions based on the evidence or just about anything else they want to make a decision based on. And it's really hard to tell what's going to... It's like that old line about infinite monkeys and infinite typewriters, and one of them will eventually write Hamlet. Lawyers can sit there and say and put their case together and say, oh, this will get them. This will nail it. And then if you interview them afterward, they're, no, actually, my hemorrhoids were acting up, and I wanted to get out of there, and it seemed like most folks wanted him guilty, so I wanted him guilty, too. The jury system is a good system, but even good systems can be flawed systems. So that's, I think it's always beneficial to understand that. Other things for this Friday on the front porch, because it is, in fact, Friday on the front porch. Other things for this Friday on the front porch, well, there's plenty of it. Apparently, Marion Pat Robertson has become bulimic because he's talking about vomiting a lot these days. And let's see, protecting freedom in State College, Pennsylvania. We've got that. A horrifying tale of the rise of the police state in the United States. We got that. And somewhere along the way, I do want to talk a little bit about the latest alleged revelations about the domestic surveillance that takes place in the United States. And oddly enough, it will be a discussion of lawyering and what the facts are in the domestic spying issue versus the way the story itself is being framed and put forward. And I think I mean framed in both senses of the word. Framed as in parameters delineated in which we will describe the subject at hand, and also framed as in there's a little bit of a frame job going here. So we've got that going for us. The country is, well, I don't know. Some portion of the country is still deeply concerned about what happened with the Farm Bill and with the needs of certain human beings in America to eat in order to go on being human beings. Might talk about that a little bit. I think we can definitely have a lovely conversation about the secessionist movement in Colorado. Absolutely. Let's see. We've still got people fascinated with how and where certain people go to the sanitary facilities. A story of desperation arising in Alabamistan. And a little story of the beauties of the free market arising out of how did Rudyard Kipling spell it and pronounce it? India. India. More free market economic transubstantive miracles. This time on the Indian subcontinent. Sound like a busy night to you? It does to me. And thank you. Thank you, Frankie, for getting us started this evening. We are now at 200 and... Wait. $240. I told you. Math is not my strong suit. $240. To get us to the end of the evening in the good. Thank you very much, Frankie. It is deeply appreciated. Let's see. A note coming in from Sergi. No time is safe, is the subject line. Oh, cut me a break, Bob. Bob Alcantara. And here I thought it was safe to drink soda at least until the intro's over. Signed, Sergi, I just contributed root beer to my monitor again, Kyle. I thought I'd mentioned that before. Way back when, in America's fifth smallest radio market, my old granddaddy said, "Son, if you're going to do anything in the world, be fifth best at it." Back in America's fifth smallest radio market, Beckley, West Virginia, when in 2004. I had the temerity to suggest that what was going on in Iraq might be just a tad criminal, might be just a tad wrong, immoral, that, you know, torturing people for information wasn't a good idea. You know, all those things that turned out that we were very, very, very correct about. The little knuckle-mocking, mouth-breathing, toenail-toothpicking right-wingers dubbed me that. They dubbed me Bob Alcantara. They also occasionally called me Baghdad Bob. Nice people, huh? But it is 16 minutes past the hour, and we're going to go now to the phone lines, and I do believe we have noted Charleston, West Virginia trial lawyer Timothy Kuntz on the line. Hey, Tim, how you doing?
Hey, Bob, how are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good.
Baghdad lately?
Just passing through every now and then, you know, stop for a cup of tea there in the souk, and yeah, you know, hang out with my pals.
Yeah, my son has spent the last 2 years in the Middle East.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he's a national security scholar and has the government's assistance learned 4 dialects of Arabic.
He has my sincere congratulations, because learning one dialect of Arabic is a pretty tall hurdle.
Well, I'm awfully proud of him.
You rightfully so. Well, where is he studying?
He's at Johns Hopkins now in D.C. at their School of Advanced International Studies. And starts his first semester in about 3 weeks.
Wow. Wow. Well, certainly high praise is due to you for having raised so successful and successfully educated such an obviously intelligent son. You've done good, as we say in these parts.
Thanks, Bob.
I was looking at some of your musings on the Zimmerman trial earlier today, and that was what prompted me to get in touch with you. Because, as I was saying before we brought you on, and I've already done the glowing introduction, that's why I just brought you on, telling folks who you are and what you've done. The coverage and media is sort of a specialty of mine, I like to think. The coverage of this trial has been abysmal, embarrassing, sensationalistic, what have you.
Very similar to the O.J. trial.
If the O.J. trial could have been done any worse, it would have been the Zimmerman trial.
Correct. Could not agree with you more.
And I think that raises issues of, you want the courts to be open to everybody, and by everybody we mean everybody, but by the same token, do we really have to have a circus around it as well, Tim?
Well, I couldn't agree with you more, Bob. And I have tried a number of high-profile trials. And if one had gone by what was in the media, the Charleston Gazette, some of the TV stations, one would really wonder why my clients were acquitted. Because unless you're sitting in the courtroom every day and you watch the jury's reaction to the evidence, and as trial lawyers, we are sort of always in a trial on the seat of our pants. I mean, you know, sitting on the edge of our seat, because we're very attuned to the vibes of the jury. And, I've been in the middle of opening statement before in a high-profile homicide case and seen the jury's seen the jury roll their eyes in response to some of the things I was saying, and realized right there and then that I had to change horses in midstream and ultimately got an acquittal in the case. You know, juries are much smarter than people give them credit for. They are... I had one case one time where I was clearly winning it, and my client was a sexual predator, and I was aware of certain evidence that led me to believe privately that he was guilty. Yet the trial just completely, totally fell apart for the prosecution. And the jury convicted him anyways. And they saw through to the truth. And I've never lost a trial where I thought my client was innocent, and I've actually never won a trial where my client was I thought my client was guilty. And I can tell you that I've lost very few trials, in fact, a handful in a 30-year career. But I have always been impressed with the level of intelligence, intuition, and hard work of juries, especially around the state in West Virginia. I've tried cases in...
And, of course, in West Virginia, it's a significantly different situation than what we see in Florida, in that West Virginia still has a 12-person jury.
That's correct. But like Florida, it also has to be a unanimous verdict.
Right. The other difference, and I would appreciate it if you would go into this a little bit, Tim. In West Virginia, a person charged with a felony has to be charged via a grand jury presentment, unless they have waived their right to the same and agree to proceed by information. And information
is absolutely correct. But in Florida, the prosecutor actually has discretion over whether to present it to a grand jury or not.
Do you think that that has an impact on the jury as to, I mean, is there an inclination to ask, well, you know, why didn't 16 people tried and true get to hear this and decide whether or not to issue a true bill?
You know, that's a really interesting question that you pose, and I have thought about that quite a bit in my career. A grand jury, you know, the saying goes, would indict a ham sandwich if the prosecutor wanted them to, because they strictly control, the prosecutor strictly controls the flow of evidence before them. I happen to think that a grand jury is a good thing for a defense counsel. But, you know, in the grand scheme of things, the way the evidence is presented, I don't think in terms of getting an indictment, it's really that significant, with a few exceptions. I had a murder case early in my career where a grand jury returned 6 no true bills until a special prosecutor went back and got a true bill. And then it was a murder case, and it ended up with an acquittal. But the victim's family in that case truly felt denied of justice up until the time that the indictment was returned and was tried, and then the Pettit jury brought back an acquittal. So, you know, I do have to say that in many ways it relieves the prosecutor of his discretion, although he's still exercising it through the flow of evidence he allows in front of them. But in a lot of ways, it gives a lot of satisfaction to the victim's family, because, you know, it results, eventually in, someone hearing it one way or the other, and returning a true or a not true bill. As a defense lawyer, you know, I really enjoy the grand jury because everyone has to get up, or the arresting officer gets up and gives his statement, testimony before the grand jury. And the more anyone gives a statement, the more they're going to make mistakes, and we obviously get those transcripts. And I've had several grand juries dismissed because of prosecutorial misconduct during the course of the grand jury, and or the witness misrepresented something. And in several cases of domestic violence, I've actually put my clients on before the grand jury in homicide cases, and it resulted in a true bill without the necessity of trial. So I have to say that I'm a big fan of the grand jury system. Is it absolutely necessary? No. But I think it gives everyone involved a better sense of justice. In the
legitimacy.
Legitimacy, exactly. That's probably the best term that could be applied to it. So, you know, I would hope that we never change the grand jury system that we have in West Virginia.
And, in fact, Florida's system is, there are a couple of other states where you can do this, but Florida's system is not a complete anomaly, but there are more states in this country that require an indictment than allow a prosecutor to bring a felony charge on his or her own decision.
That's absolutely correct. And in the federal system, it's uniform. There are always grand juries that return indictments. And I think that's a good thing. And I think that jurisprudence we should keep in West Virginia.
Well, in this particular case, you have you've said, and you're kind of running against the tide on this a little bit, at least as far as what I can read, that you think there's a decent chance for conviction. Why is that?
Yeah, well, if I were sitting on the jury, I would convict him probably of manslaughter. And that must sound strange coming from a criminal defense lawyer who defends men like Zimmerman every day. But I think the prosecution has made an extremely effective case for a manslaughter conviction. Actually, I think they've made a case for a second, but I think manslaughter offers the jury a brokered verdict in this situation. I'll just run through my musings on it, and
sure.
You and I have already discussed this, but you know, I thought the prosecution did a much better job than the defense, and, of course, to hear the media talk about it, that would be just the opposite. Of course, in the O.J. case, I thought it was going to be an acquittal, and everyone else thought it was going to be a conviction. But I was on vacation for the last 2 weeks and had an opportunity while, you know, working on briefs on my laptop to dial into just about 95% of the trial, including all of the openings, closings, and key witnesses.
You know, that's almost a joke, Tim. What does a lawyer do on his vacation? Watches other lawyers.
Yeah, and that's a good point. But, Bob, I wanted to be a lawyer all my life, and I live and breathe the practice. And I'll be a lawyer up until the point that I die, and will be standing next to men and women that have been charged with crime and seeking justice for them. But in the course of that, I made some notes and thought through it carefully. It's a very difficult case for the prosecution because it is a circumstantial case in which it's basically a he say, she say scenario in which one of the persons is dead. But what was unique about this case is that Zimmerman talked to the police quite a bit, gave a number of statements, had, I believe, some very poor representation at first. And they walked him through videos, reenactments. He gave multiple statements, and those have basically been used, he's been used as the witness against him. And let me respectfully point out some of the things that I think are important here.
Sure.
You basically have a case where the prosecution's case came down to this. They started with Zimmerman's four-letter recorded epithets towards Martin at the beginning that were recorded on the 911 tape. It evolved into video and recorded statements about his pursuit, which revealed three completely different stories he told about what was happening. And the prosecutor really wove those together nicely with video snippets in his closing statement. He used the physical evidence to show that despite what all the defense expert witnesses said, and that the physical evidence really disputed much of it, and I'll be specific on that. I might also point out that the defense excessive force expert that they used has been barred from testifying in every trial he's appeared in West Virginia. No judge has found his evidence to be credible, and I was surprised that the judge permitted him to testify in the Zimmerman case. But anyways, some of the important things are that there was no blood at all on Trayvon's hands. And if you'll remember, Zimmerman claimed that he had him pinned, his nose was bleeding, he said Martin had his hand over his mouth, that he Martin saw his gun and he went for it, had his hand on his gun. Of course, another time he said he didn't have his hand on his gun, that he was moving for it, and another time he said he did. There were no prints, DNA, blood found on the gun, no blood found on Zimmerman, on Martin's hands at all, and the pictures of Zimmerman clearly showed blood under his nose. And the prosecution put together a nice summary chart of all the different fairy tales Zimmerman had told about why he had pursued him, what happened in the course of the fight. And with regard to the gun, he claimed that Martin saw his gun and went for it, yet all of the neighbors testified that it was too dark to see. Zimmerman also testified that his gun was in an inside-the-pants holster that was black. The gun was black, and it was in the smaller area of his back behind him. It was not on his side. He was on his back. So, really, that story he told was just implausible, totally implausible, plus the fact that there was no contact evidence on the gun whatsoever. And what you basically are left with in this case is a guy who wrongfully profiled him, whether it was for race or his appearance or whatever, and suspected him of being in the course of committing a crime, and he was wrong about it, called the police, alerted them to it. They told him, essentially, stand down, that we don't need you to follow him, unlike some of the commentators. They did not instruct him to stay in the truck, but they told him he didn't need to follow him. We don't need you to follow him. But Zimmerman, who claimed he was afraid of Martin, got out of the truck. And why would someone who claimed that they were in fear of Martin get out of the truck and follow him? And the answer is simple. Because he had a gun, and he thought his gun was an equalizer. He thought at some point he could pull his gun out and use it as an equalizer between the two of them. And he, you know, made the really almost criminal mistake of getting out of the truck and following him. And in self-defense law, if you initiate an altercation, it is difficult, if not impossible, for you to legally claim self-defense when it turns against you. And Zimmerman was playing a quasi-mall cop here, and he wanted to actually get into the fray of this. And I think it's pretty clear from the evidence, and the problem with his testimony is that he told so many stories about what he was doing that none of them were really plausible. And Mark Twain said it best, the easiest thing about telling the truth is that there's so little you have to remember. So basically, what you have here is a guy that wrongfully profiled a young, innocent man, followed him when he was instructed to stand down, or that he was informed that the police did not need him to do that. He said that he did it to find out what street he was on, yet there were only three streets in the area. He had been on the watch there for 2 years. He knew the three streets, and when he did the walkthrough with him, he just peeled off the name of the street like he had, you know, lived there his entire life, so that was obviously a fabrication. It was clear that he was stalking him that night. And here what you have is a young kid who's going home being stalked by sort of a creepy-looking guy who he described to his friend as a cracker, or creepy cracker, and whether you think that's a racial term or not, it was certainly creepy what he was doing to this innocent kid.
Stalking, isn't it? I mean,
yeah, he was clearly stalking him. And you know, unlike what many commentators have indicated, that they thought that perhaps Martin did confront him, I don't think that Martin did confront him. I think that Zimmerman went after him, and I think with all the lies he told so far that the jury can easily infer that. And I think he confronted him, attempted to detain him, and it went badly for him. And then in the course of it, and let's keep in mind, this was not introduced into evidence, but Zimmerman's history has been one of domestic violence with his domestic partners and with a police officer that showed up one time. So, you know, he's got a history of physical altercations with people and restraining orders. And Zimmerman got into confrontation with Martin. Of course, the evidence about the prior incidents that he'd been in did not come into evidence and probably shouldn't have come into evidence unless he took the witness stand. But he got into an altercation with him, and was overpowered with him. He claimed he was in fear of his life and he was having his head banged against the concrete, yet we know from the evidence that the fight and from the neighbor's testimony that the fight did not occur on the concrete and that he had some slight scratches on the back of his head, which when shaved and cleaned did not leave any scars at all the next day, and that his nose, despite what was indicated that may have been fractured, had a straight septum. No x-rays were done. He never went back for follow-up treatment. There was no medical evidence that was broken at all, other than some opinions that held no weight at all because no diagnostic tests were done. And people, you know, look at the picture of Zimmerman. They say, oh, my God, look at his distended, swollen nose. Well, if you take the blood away and compare it to his nose in the pre-fight pictures, it was identical. And
it's
it was
the same nose.
Yeah, it was the same nose. There was really, if you look at the other picture pre-fight looks like it was swollen as well, and perhaps it had been broken in the past or something. But and one of the things you need to keep in mind is that this is a six-woman jury, and three of those women on the jury have rather specific medical training. And, you know, are really able to cut through this stuff. And, you know, who knows what an all-female jury will do. I can tell you from my experience, it's usually the opposite of what an all-male jury will do. Then you throw in the fact that afterwards, it was very poorly investigated by the police. They rushed to a conclusion. The conclusion was, oh, there's a dead black kid there, and you know, this guy shot him, and they did not gather the evidence that should have been gathered. They didn't do an autopsy until the lead investigator was replaced in the case. And at that point, they finally did one. A lot of the crucial evidence was lost.
Well, let me ask you a couple of particular questions, if I may, please, Tim.
Sure.
One is, you know, you mentioned the multiple self-contradictory statements that Zimmerman made. Is that why his counsel chose not to put him on the stand?
Yes, and also when you take the witness stand, you open yourself up, you open your character up to state witnesses to rebut your character, and he could have been asked about all the prior domestic altercations that he'd been in. And by not taking the witness stand, he really boxed in the prosecution for most of his past history that could be presented. And, you know, a lot of people say, well, what about those text messages that Trayvon had on his cell phone? Well, what about them? I mean, most of them had been taken out of context. They didn't reveal really any kind of violent history. It was a bunch of kids talking, where Zimmerman, in fact, had a very violent history. And a history of beating women and getting into a fight with a police officer. So, you know, it's not a far leap if he had taken the witness stand that all that would have come in. And that would have painted a very different picture of Zimmerman than has been in the media. Now, personally, should that have come in or should that have been spread across the media about his background? Well, no, because I really think that you try to get as insulated a jury as you can. And despite how stupid West's knock-knock joke was in the opening statement, it was really true. You know, finding people that had not heard of this case or did not significantly know much about it was very difficult here. And they've sequestered this jury the entire time from any kind of media input. Their internet and phone communications are monitored. Their rooms are searched when they're in the jury room to make sure they're not, you know, maintaining diaries. You know, it's tough being on a jury, but you really want the jury just to hear what the evidence is at the trial and not come in with any preconceived notion. So to get back to your original question, it would have been, I think, legal malpractice to put him on. I think he wanted to take the stand because every opportunity he had to give a different version of what happened, he took advantage of. And given his track record of his multiple inconsistent statements, no lawyer in their right mind would have let him get near the witness box.
Well, then, follow up to that, then, is it problematic that the judge asked Zimmerman to assert his Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination in front of the jury?
No, I believe that that was not done in front of the jury. I may be mistaken on that, because that part I heard on the radio, but those are based usually in camber or held outside the province of the jury. I would be surprised if that occurred here. And I may be wrong on that point. As far as the judge asking him those questions, the judge is required to ask him those questions. You know, a lot of people have beaten up on the judge for how she talked to defense counsel in this case, but quite frankly,
defense counsel wasn't being deferential.
It's not just being deferential. I mean, once you make an objection on the record, that's it. And West had a bad habit of kicking dead horses, and, you know, he had made his record, but he just wasn't going to leave it at that. And if you don't like what you put on the record, then you can overnight botch the record with an additional pleading, and that's what's the standard practice here. Much of what West was doing was playing to the cameras and playing to his client. And I can't say I blame him for that, because when you're in a case like this, you want your client to feel as if you're pulling out every stop, you're standing up to the judge, and, you know, if it goes bad, at least, you know, the client always says, well, that guy did everything he could to help me. He fought with the judge every day.
Well,
at a certain point, you know, you start burning bridges with the judge, and then it eats into, you know, her opinion on discretionary rulings, and sometimes it comes back and bite you where you don't want to be bit.
Because juries tend to look at the judge as the good guy or good woman, and when a lawyer starts really getting into it with the judge, that can influence the jury itself, can it not?
Yeah, the judge has a tremendous influence over the jury, and interfering with their shepherd, who is the judge, is one of the biggest mistakes that you can ever make in front of the jury. And Bob, I may be wrong on this, but I was pretty sure that colloquy that we just spoke with, where they inquired into the defendant's choice of taking the stand, I'm pretty sure that was outside the province of the
jury. Well, I read that it had taken place, and, you know, that relying on media reports, that it had taken place in front of the jury, I was rather shocked.
And perhaps it did. I mean, I heard it on the radio, and that was actually part of the trial that I did not see. And, after we conclude this interview, I'm going to go back and follow up on that.
I may be wrong. It may just it may have been characterized in what I read simply because it was done in the courtroom itself as opposed to in camera, and then nothing is ever said further about it.
Yeah, because in West Virginia, those conversations always take place outside the province of the jury, and in federal court, they always take place outside the province of the jury.
You mentioned defense counsel playing to the camera. Let me go back to that, because we talked a little bit about the effect of media coverage on a trial. When of course it was a pool feed, but when there are cameras set up in a courtroom, does that change the dynamic? Does it change the atmosphere as such? I mean, is there an element of can't help but look at the camera that comes into play?
No, because, you know, when you're trying a case, you know, the back of your neck's standing up, your adrenaline is, you know, flowing, you are focused on every aspect of the trial, and it's really the last thing you're thinking about in the course of trying a case. Where it's important is when you step outside of the courtroom, into the court of public opinion, and how that is shaped, both before, during, and after the trial. And the worst thing you can do as a defense lawyer when you walk out of the courtroom and they stick a microphone in your face is to say, no comment. It looks like you're hiding something. And I teach lawyers this in seminars. And you need to step out and aggressively defend your client before those cameras. And you need to, no matter what the questions are, you need to have several pre-written sound bites, because no matter what they ask you, they'll always edit out the question and they'll just play your sound bite. So, you know, that's what I tell lawyers to do, because more prosecutor and defense counsel careers have been killed by a camera than by a gun.
That's absolutely the truth, and that's the way that that's the nature of what I refer to as the for-profit media in a nutshell. They're selling papers or selling laundry detergent, as opposed to actually delivering information to people who need it. Let's go back to a couple of other things that you have alluded to. You were talking about making the record, and once you've made your objection, does it strike you that there's a whole lot of is there much in the way of close calls in this case that would make for a meritorious defense appeal of a guilty verdict?
Not that I have seen. Of course, in Florida, who knows? They have somewhat of a liberal Supreme Court down there. And it's actually a very, very good Supreme Court.
Had they been listened to, we would have been talking about President Gore for 8 years.
Yeah, that's correct. And funny you should mention that. Justice O'Connor recently said that she regrets her vote in that case.
When I heard that, I cried up. I queued up Cry Me a River.
This case has been very well tried. You know, the Anthony case, the OJ case, there was truly an imbalance of talent in those cases on either side of the bar. But in this particular case, with the exception of the stupid knock-knock joke that West told, West and O'Mara have done absolutely an incredible job here. And the two prosecutors were outstanding. I mean, the one thing that I can point out in this case is that the general public has seen some really good lawyering on both sides. I've been very impressed. Now, a lot of people have been critical, and a lot of armchair legal commentators have criticized the prosecution for putting all of the evidence in, some of which hurt them. But, you know, that's a neophyte's call. You know, when you're the prosecutor and you know some stuff out there can help you and hurt you, it's better that you put it out and you control it and you control the questioning of it and you neutralize it before the other side gets up or calls that witness and shows that you've been trying to hide something. And I thought that was very effective on the part of the prosecutor here.
Well, and in fact, a prosecutor has a different, to a certain degree, a different duty than does defense counsel in any criminal trial.
Well, and that's a very good point. The prosecutor is both the sword and the shield, and he has a discretion in all cases that he's required to exercise. He has to not only present his case in the most favorable light, but he has to be very respectful of the defendant's rights and flow of information. He can't hide evidence. He can't go into areas that are violative of the defendant's rights. He can't, believe it or not, give his personal opinion about the case.
No.
And the defense counsel is just the opposite, and our jobs are very difficult in that category because we are required to go full speed. We wear blinders. We're supposed to be aggressive, zealous advocates. If we see where the prosecution is about to make a mistake or do something that might hurt their own case or allow some deadline to lapse, we're not allowed to call them up and point that out to them. In fact, it would be malpractice, and I'd be up before the State Bar Disciplinary Committee if I did. We have to wear blinders in our role. And I think O'Mara and West, whatever anyone says about them, I think they've done really an outstanding job, although I personally believe that O'Mara's closing was a little lackluster, and of course I may be proven wrong with the verdict, but I don't think so. I think he could have done a better job of threading the needle and pulling all of his facts together, and I think he could have shown more emotion, and there's no doubt that he's a very competent defense counsel, and he used to be a prosecutor himself and had a reputation for being an outstanding prosecutor. No one can say that he hasn't done a good job for Zimmerman. I quite frankly think that Zimmerman has been the client from hell. You know, there was a lot of crowdsourcing done for his defense that brought, you know, donations from the entire rainbow of political incorrectness. And Zimmerman used most of that money to pay off his credit cards from before the trial.
Well, you don't want that. You don't want that interest racking up while you're in the stir.
Yeah, and you know, and lived off it, and really had a better lifestyle off of that than he did before. And very little of it actually went to his defense. And O'Mara and West have basically been doing this case for free for him, obviously with an eye towards selling the movie and book rights and, you know, generating their fees off of that as well as speaking fees post-trial, whether they win or lose. But I can tell you that winning in these cases is wonderful, and losing in these cases is more expensive than you can ever imagine.
Well, let's talk about that for just a minute, please, if we could.
Sure.
Tell folks a little bit about the time commitment. I mean, a lawyer never... Well, a good one at least, never has one case. You've got file cabinets full of them, equally demanding upon your time.
That's correct. Anyone?
What happens in one of these things when you get into a, you know, a real, you know, Captain Ahab situation out in the longboat looking, you know, trying to reel in the big one?
Well, let me just go through an ordinary day. I mean, any lawyer at any one time that handles these types of cases obviously handles many of them, and you have to, going into the trial, rearrange your entire docket, put everything on hold, do a series of continuances on every case you have. You meet with your scheduling staff, usually during the noon hour to put out the fires. You usually get up about 5 or 6 in the morning. You go over your testimony. You get to the courthouse. You try the case for 8 to 12 hours, and then you immediately go home, have a short bite, and then you meet with your witnesses for the next day and prep them for their testimony. And then each day you're also reviewing and preparing what you're ultimately going to give for your closing statement. And by the time you try to get around to sleep, you still have the taste of adrenaline in your mouth, and you usually live on 3 to 4 hours of sleep a night for several weeks at a time. And the older lawyers I know in this business, the very good ones, and I won't mention any names, but I just was talking to one of them the other day, and he told me his doctor won't let him try cases anymore because it just runs his blood pressure up too high, and he's afraid he's going to have a stroke. You know, I can't tell you the mental and physical toll that it takes on you as well as your family.
It ain't all Atticus Finch working out the entailment.
No, and, you know, and then at the end, depending on how the evidence is played out, even though you've done weeks of preparation going in with your jury instructions, at the last minute, you're always changing horses in midstream. And one of the toughest murder cases I ever had in my career, I'd spent about 8 months getting ready for it. And at the last minute, I had asked the judge for co-counsel because it was an appointed case, and he always let people have two lawyers, handle those. And he didn't appoint a new lawyer for me until about a week before the trial. And the new lawyer came in, and he looked at all my evidence. He'd never tried a murder case before, and he'd never really tried anything significant before. And my client was accused of beating an 18-month-old baby to death and had been held in jail for a year without bond. And on the cusp of the trial, the other counsel came to me the night before, and he said, I think I've got a better theory of this case. I think we should do it this way. And, of course, I told him I thought he was as full of crap as a Christmas turkey. And then as I drove to the trial that morning, and I had about an hour and a 15-minute drive to the trial, I thought over and over about what he had suggested. And 5 minutes before the trial started, I completely changed my theory of the case and went with his suggestion, changed horses in midstream, told the jury that my client had been wrongfully charged that time and place would trap the true killer, and before the trial was over with, the real murderer would take the witness stand. And, of course, the mother's boyfriend, during my cross-examination of her, took the witness stand, and during cross-examination admitted to having done it, and the jury acquitted him.
Oh, my God, that's straight out of Perry Mason.
And interesting aspect about that case, Bob, is that the judge, along with the community, I mean, I used to get hate calls on that, and people didn't, you know, how could you represent this guy? And I would get death threats left on my answering machine. The people not knowing that I had been involuntarily appointed to this case by the judge and had no choice in taking it whatsoever, and the maximum fee that I could get out of the whole case for a year's work was $1,000, and I had no expenses. So one day, the local Methodist minister came by my office and told me that the president of the bank had died and left behind a large trust fund for needy people in the community. And did I know anyone? And I said, well, no. I said, but I knew a leper who was charged wrongfully with a crime and would probably go to trial and be convicted because he didn't have the resources to defend himself. And he asked me a little bit about this case, and I told him. And he said, well, what do you need? And I said, well, I'd like to hire Dr. Cyril Wecht, and he's up in Pittsburgh. And, of course, you know, Wecht is one of the most famous forensic pathologists in the world. He was commissioned by Congress to reexamine the Kennedy assassination. It was the first one to dispel the single bullet theory. And it was $15,000. And so he went back and looked at my file and went back and talked to his congregation and brought me back a check for $15,000, all of which went to Dr. Wecht. And Dr. Wecht got with treating physicians for this small child, and they determined that the time frame that the prosecution put together just didn't make sense. And it was only the mother's boyfriend that was really there during the time frame when this child was beaten. And that's not what my co-counsel pointed out. He had actually pointed out that there was a witness that also established that my client was not in the apartment when this remark was heard about beating the child. And he had done a great job pulling that out. When it was all said and done, this church that had never met this kid put up $15,000 on faith. And when the whole trial was over with and he was acquitted, the Gazette came down and put my picture and this minister's picture on the front page of the paper. And I went from being the most hated person in the community to getting murder cases all over the state. But I just had faith in my client. And that's what it takes in these cases. And, you know, no matter how much we dislike Zimmerman, Mark O'Meara has faith in his client, and he and West have done, you know, an exemplary job of representing them.
Well, elaborate on one thing, if you would, please, based on what you've just mentioned. You said early in our conversation you referred to whether I believe my client is guilty or if I believed my client was not guilty.
I'm glad you brought that up because
no lawyer, I mean, people say things like, well, I could never be a lawyer because I couldn't defend somebody I knowed was guilty.
Yeah, maybe I should rephrase that a little bit. That case taught me to have faith in my client. Because early on in that case, I, along with the community, sort of decided that he perhaps was guilty. And I was going to fight like a dog for him, and I didn't think it was a good case against him. And then, you know, the harder and harder I worked, the court appointed my former trial professor from WVU as the special prosecutor in the case. And she came down and looked at the case, and she thought there were some issues in it. So she offered my client a involuntary manslaughter plea right before the trial, and he'd already pulled a year, and, you know, this 20-year-old kid at the time could have taken that plea and walked out of the courthouse with his sentence pulled. And he turned it down. He turned it down, Bob, because he told me he just didn't do it. And at that point, I had faith in him. And he gave me also faith in myself. And I tried that case, and, you know, and obviously got acquitted, but it taught me something, that it's not our job as defense lawyers to ever determine how hard we work a case or what the result should be based on our own beliefs. We just need to do our job. let the evidence fall into place. You know, we are charged with aggressively and zealously representing our clients, and that is our role. And the prosecutor's role is much different because he or she is both the sword of the community and the shield of the defendant's rights. So, you know, it's an interesting dichotomy that has played out in this case, how it ends. You know, I've told you what I think the result will be. Female jurors are much different than male jurors, and I'm interested to see how they handle this. If it was an all-male jury in Florida, of all places, I would probably predict that this would be a rather quick conviction. But this is an all-female jury, and they look at these cases much differently.
Well, is there any validity then to what I thought was a fairly outrageous statement by Geraldo Rivera, you know, over on Radio Rwanda, that's what we call Fox News around here, to the effect that he was of the opinion that all six of the women on the jury would have shot Trayvon Martin even faster than Zimmerman did.
I think that's a ludicrous statement coming from Geraldo, who's Hispanic and a lawyer. You know, I think that's deplorable. And I also think it's deplorable how Mark O'Mara profiled Martin in front of the jury by pointing out that all the break-ins in that area had been by black people. That is, all the people who were caught had been black. You couldn't infer that all the break-ins had been from African Americans.
Well, there does seem to be the responses on the right wing in particular, Tim, and I explained to people before you came on the program that the liberal community in West Virginia is a small and merry band, and that you and I are both members of it.
But proud.
and proud, damn straight. There is a strain of something genuinely evil working in the right wing, and maybe that's just because they're who they are. You can almost hear Sean Hannity salivating for a race war, and conspiracies being posited about the DOJ community team coming down saying, okay, we're going to, no matter how this ends, we're going to keep a cool head, right? And suddenly, you know, that's part of the Kenyan Muslim socialist plot for world domination or something. What is the? I mean, we're having a conversation here of which I am very proud. But in the larger media world, let's talk a minute about these so-called expert lawyers who get on various networks and pontificate. Are they really there to offer the kind of expertise that you have just offered over the course of this conversation, or are they there to gin up sensationalism and sell soap?
Well, obviously you've got your finger on the pulse of it, Bob. You know, sensationalism sells. I mean, if we've seen that at all, it's the ratings of MSNBC amongst liberals soars, the ratings of Fox amongst conservative soars. I'm not going to say which one I think is closer to being fair and balanced. But, you know, I think what we've seen is that the loonies on all sides have come out of the woodwork and are all of a sudden legitimate on television now, where there was an effort to, you know, with the fairness doctrine that, you know, is no longer there, to present a more moderate viewpoint. Ed Rabel is a real close friend of mine.
Oh, I'm an Ed fan.
And Ed, I've helped him get a scholar-in-residence position at a prep school up in the Northeast and helped fund it. And he taught a journalism class up there. And what he really tried to emphasize to his students, and that I think was really laudable, was that you should present the facts such that at the end your listening audience really can't tell what side you're on, that you present the entire story and let them make the decision.
The real We Report, You Decide.
Yes. And of course, you know, Ed grew up amongst Cronkite and a lot of really good reporters from CBS who, you know, had were liberal but also had conservative traits to them and were all products of World War II. And were, you know, in many ways more deferential towards the government until the Vietnam War. But, you know, if you've ever heard Ed speak at the end of it, you really have a good idea what happened, but you can't really tell what his opinion is. Now, of course, his written opinion, his editorials, are, he makes it pretty clear what his opinions are.
Oh, yes.
But, you know, when Ed speaks to a wide audience, he really just, you know, delves into indisputable facts and doesn't taint them or shade them. And I think we could use more journalism like that these days. And I think, you know, we as lawyers in law school are taught one day to argue just aggressively one side of the case, and then the next day our assignment is to come in and argue the other side of the case just as passionately in a manner where, you know, by the end of people hearing both sides, they can't really tell which one you agree with. And I was on the trial competition for the law school and went to the Nationals for WVU. And, you know, one day we would at the Nationals argue one side of the trial, and then the next day we'd argue the other. And, you know, we really, as lawyers, are journeymen. You know, we take up our clients' causes. And in this particular case, though, I think you've just seen some of the best lawyering in the history of jurisprudence in this case, and a lot of people disagree with it, but of the televised trials I've seen, in terms of equal ability on both sides, this has truly been the best. Another good trial I saw was Jerry Spence's last trial in Detroit, where I went up there as the legal whisperer for a national magazine to explain a lot of what was going on. And Jerry Spence, the U.S. attorney in Detroit, tried the Figer case, and where Figer was charged with using straw parties to he gave his employees a bunch of money to in turn give it back to him so that he could give it to the people, the Edwards campaign, and that's actually illegal, and he was charged with it in Figer's defense, and Spence did a great job putting it on, was even though I'm one of the most well-known effective lawyers in the country, I was too stupid to know it was illegal, and it actually worked in front of the jury. And he was acquitted. He was Kevorkian's lawyer.
That's where I recognized the name.
Yeah, and it was a very interesting trial, and I learned a lot from being with Jerry Spence, and I think Jerry Spence is really our preeminent lawyer, but Jerry doesn't try cases at all anymore. That was his last trial. And it was just magnificent. He will truly go down in history as not only one of the great human beings, but one of the best lawyers we've ever had. Roy Black down in Florida is another great lawyer. I've really been interested in his take on it. Of course, he's been pro-defense. He represented William Kennedy Smith.
Right.
In that case, did a very effective job on it. The Casey Anthony case, that was some of the worst prosecuting I've ever seen. The OJ
Since the
case,
OJ trial.
It was deplorable, and that was some of the best work on the part of the defendant I'd ever seen. Johnny Cochran was just amazing. Effley Bailey was amazing in that case. Effley Bailey was disbarred not long after that and has been disbarred since then, and just recently the Maine bar has he got thrown out every jurisdiction he was in, and Maine has now allowed him to be admitted again, but he's in his 80s, but, you know, he still has talents. And
of course, when you talk about old disbarred lawyers, Tim, I immediately think of Arch Moore saying to the West Virginia State Bar, "I want to die a lawyer." And, you know, my first response was, "I want you to, too, and the sooner the better."
Well,
but I mean that way, so. You know.
Well, yeah, Arch Moore, you know, and I'll say this clearly, the problem with Arch, but not that he was a crook, it was that he was really such a petty crook. And Arch would never admit wrongdoing. Once he took a plea, he did everything to back out of it and said he was insane, and he had hired one of the best lawyers in D.C., and he accused that guy of every kind of malpractice. And you know, the bar wants to see that you've atoned for, you know, that you've realized that you've made some mistakes and you're not going to make them again. Of course, Arch would never admit to that, and they will never let him practice law again.
Which is probably a net positive.
One of my very good friends got disbarred a few years ago for getting caught up in some political corruption. He's been disbarred for about 7 years, and he just got turned down again, and I said, well, you know, I think your approach is wrong. I think what you need to go back to the bar and say is, look, I was wrong, which is what he had done. But then I have talents, and I'd like to use those talents for legal aid. I'd like to use them for representing indigent clients in criminal cases, and I don't want to get back into practice for the money. I want to get back into practice because I want to do good things for people that can't afford a lawyer. I want to be their advocate. And I want to do it for the highest tenets of the profession, not for self-gain or to be able to tell people I'm a lawyer. And I think that is so lost these days. People ask me, how did you have such a successful legal career? Well, the reason why was I never cared about the money at first. I mean, I care about the clients. I wanted to be a problem solver. I wanted to get in and make their lives better after they had left my office than it was before they came to me. And the money in those situations will come. Now, you know, you can't let people use you, and you got to pick and choose, you know, what causes to carry the sword for. But, you know, as a lawyer, your eye always needs to be on being a problem solver and improving your client's life and you know, dealing with injustices. I represented a woman one time that had no money. She came to me, and she had shot her husband, and he had beaten her up repeatedly, broke every bone in her body. The police would never come or intervene or anything else, and finally one night he came in drunk and after paint huffing and backed her into a corner, and she finally shot him. And I tried that case in front of the grand jury, and it was no bill in front of the grand jury, and when that happened, his life insurance proceeds came through, and she gave them to me without me asking. And I'll never forget that because I'd never taken that case for the money. I took it because I thought what the system had done to her was wrong. And, you know, there are those kind of rewards in this business if your goal in it is not to be a bean counter and to figure out how much money you can make off each client. That always leaves dissatisfied, angry lawyers in life because this is a profession where we serve. It's not a profession where we cash in. And I've just never known any lawyer in life who was obsessed with money that ever made very much of it. You know, you see these very successful civil lawyers and mass tort lawyers. I can tell you, they didn't take those cases because it was clear there'd be a lot of money. They took long shots and invested their own money in it, and it came back, and there was never any guarantee in the first place. And, you know, I think, you know, lawyers get a bad rap in our society, and there's certainly enough out there that, you know, generate the basis for it. But overall, most of the lawyers I know are very committed to their clients. You know, the bar did a study a few years ago in West Virginia as to how much money lawyers made, and they found that the average annual lawyer salary was about $45,000. And that's not a lot of money. I mean, considering the fact that you've got a 7-year degree and a doctorate. And, you know, but most of us don't get into it for the money. We get into it because we want to better people's lives. And I think the better lawyers who have that as their goal are the more successful lawyers and earn better money because of it.
Well, I think it's fairly, and there are lawyers and there are lawyers, and this is probably a conversation for another time, and I hope this won't be the last time you're on this air because people are listening in riveted fascination. One of the folks in the Head On Radio Network chat room, Tim, when you were telling the story of the young man falsely accused and talking about the year you worked for $1,000, ran the numbers real quick, and you'll be happy to know you made 48 cents an hour that year. But you've done a magnificent job both explaining what, you know, we tend to think, you know, there's a lot of, just like there's a lot of people who think that they're Tom Brady on Monday morning, There are a lot of people who think that they're Jerry Spence or the Melvin Belli immediately after the trial. And, well, you know, obviously. And that's one of the infuriating things about the way the for-profit media covers such things as this. But it is abundantly clear to me, and I think to the Horn family, that there's a difference between the people who enter these into these struggles, as compared to say, and I'd love to have a conversation with you about the whole NSA thing sometime too, but.
Well, and you would be surprised. Well, you probably know my take on that. I'm not a big Snowden fan.
Nor am I. But you'd be surprised the people who think he's Jesus.
Well, that wouldn't be me.
Nor I. But what I'm getting at, though, is there are people who admirably uphold the profession, and you know, then there are what did John Wayne call him in True Grit? Some pettifogging lawyer comes in and turns him loose again. You know, the pettifoggers you have always with you, I guess. But I really appreciate the time you've taken. You know, somebody that you and I both know once described the lawyer's breakfast of champions as two pots of coffee and a half a pack of Marlboro Reds. And there's a lot of people for whom that. But there's a life that goes on here. People see lawyers in front of cameras. They see lawyers, on places like Headline News, sitting by while Nancy Grace bites the head off a bat or something. And they think that that's lawyer.
Yeah.
It isn't. And in fact, if anything, I think what you've shown is that what has gone into this trial is far more than what most people suspect even goes into so much as trying somebody in small claims court for a petty larceny bust.
Well, I'll leave you with this, Bob. You know, my biggest complaint about the legal commentators is obviously for cosmetic reasons, so many of them are very young. And it's not until about 7 years, maybe 10 years into the practice as a trial attorney, with many, many trials under your belt, that you really start to realize how this business works. I have a saying that as a young lawyer, I lost cases I should have won, and as an old lawyer, I won cases I should have lost. In the Martin Zimmerman case, you've got two old lawyers. You've got old lawyers on both sides doing just a yeoman's job. And it really harkens back to, my first 7 years of practice, I had won five or six murder cases, some of them very tough. But it wasn't until about my seventh or eighth year that I ever felt like I was a lawyer. And that's when my cousin, who I grew up with like a brother, came to me and he told me that his son had stabbed a boy to death. And would I represent him? And I had carried this kid around on my shoulders when he was a baby and everything else. And, you know, I just loved the family. And I did not want to carry that responsibility. And he asked me to think about who I would send him to. And I couldn't think of anybody to send him to. And finally, I told him to come back, and I'd take the case. And he was accused of stabbing a young man repeatedly or in the chest with a butcher knife and then chasing after him for about half a mile. And in the course of that case, Irvin Sofer was still the ME. And I went to the prosecutor, and I begged her for a voluntary manslaughter plea, because they had altercations all day leading up to it. She was very unkind about it, and I was even in tears asking for it. And she turned me down. So we went to trial, and she was very abrasive to me throughout the whole trial. And she put Dr. Sofer on the stand, and before she did, I took a trip over to her counsel table, and I said, if you put Dr. Sofer on the stand, you ask him or you attempt to admit the autopsy report, it'll be the biggest mistake in your career. You'll embarrass yourself and you'll lose the trial. And she said, and I quote, F you, go back to the counsel table. So she called Dr. Sofer to the stand and put him on the stand and asked him about his examination, the manner of death, and then stood up to move the autopsy report into evidence. And it was Spike Maynard, of all people, who was the judge, and he never let the autopsy report into evidence. And he looked over at me, and I said, no objection, Your Honor. In fact, I jointly moved that document into evidence. And so I looked over at the jury, and one of the high school principals there, an African-American man who was very influential in the community in southern West Virginia, very well liked. I knew he would be the foreman. And I stood up and I asked Dr. Silver, who I always had a mercurial relationship with, if his autopsy report revealed anything about the victim's personality. And in a very condescending way, he said, "No, Tim, I have no idea what you're talking about." Silver never won a trial that I was involved in. He really disliked me and was very condescending. And I said, "Well, page 3, paragraph 2 of your report, you indicated that the victim had a large tattoo on his upper quadrant, right quadrant on his back, of a burning cross, a hooded figure, and the words Ku Klux Klan."
Oh, my God.
And, you know, the prosecutor stood up and objected, and screaming at the top of her lungs, you know, that that's irrelevant. And the judge, Spike, looked down at her and said, "Madam Prosecutor, weren't you the one that moved that document into evidence? Didn't you read it?" Said that
oh.
in front of the jury.
Oh, zing.
And, anyways, and of course, that individual was the foreman of the jury. And, but to summarize the story, the state just completely, the case fell apart. The police, the state troopers fell apart, didn't even put the body in the diagram, the crime scene diagram as to where it was, noted that there was blood all over, but it turned out to be my client's blood. And I just argued through my cross-examination in that case that my client had been attacked that night and that he defended himself and that he had been attacked several times by the same guy and that he didn't chase after him with the knife, that he was being chased by the guy after he stabbed him in self-defense. And at the close of the trial, you know, it really appeared that way. And I made the most difficult decision I'd ever made in my career, whether to put on any defense at all, whether to call any witnesses at all. Because if I put my client on or anybody else on, it may have come out that my client had chased him afterwards. And it was, the clear impression had been left that he had been the one chased. And so I closed the case without ever putting on a single witness. And it was a tough decision to make. I could just imagine if it went south on me, you know, my career would be over. And I went back in the lawyer's lounge, and about an hour later, the jury knocked on the door. And they asked for lesser included instructions again, which meant that they, you know, might have convicted him of manslaughter or something like that. And I was just sick, because if he got convicted of anything, it just would have been horrible. And then about 2 hours after that, they knocked on the door, and they came out and acquitted him. And it was at that point in my career, after I made that decision, that I never, ever doubted my abilities again. And but it takes a long time in this business and some tough calls to have that feeling. And I tell young lawyers this all the time, try as many cases as you can, because it's only experience that gets you there.
Well, that's the absolute truth. Well, let me just share a couple of things with you before you go, because you've been most generous with your time, Tim, and I appreciate it. A liberal in South Carolina just wrote in to say, "Thanks so much for the past hour." This is an email titled "Lawyering Up." Thanks so much with caps on the up. I guess that means good. Thanks so much for the past hour, the most informative explanation I've heard yet about this case and our court system. Please thank your guest for us. And then Mark writes in from San Francisco and says, listening right now to your conversation, which to my untrained ears sounds more like a wide-ranging, in-depth interview with Timothy Kuntz. More good information about this horrible case than I've heard in months of for-pay, for-go journalism, with the added benefit of insight into the mind of a decent, in all respects, lawyer. So you've made a very, very positive impression with what we call the Horn family.
And thanks to all your listeners out there for taking the time to hear about the system.
Well, do you mind if I tell folks, because you do post your good liberal-leaning thoughts out there, you mind if I tell folks that you're out there on Facebook?
Yeah, I am. It's M. Timothy Kuntz, and I'm always willing to accept new friends, and I've had daily musings about the profession, and I'm happy to share them with them.
And that is K-O-O-N-T-Z.
That's correct. I've been a country trial lawyer for 30 years, although I've represented Navy SEALs in federal court against Ross Perot in Florida federal court and gone up to Ohio, Michigan, and other places. But I started my practice in Mingo County where they had the Hatfield-McCoy feud. It was a fertile field to grow a homicide defense practice, and I think that you never get too big for your britches, but I still travel nationwide.
Well, yeah, you can take the hillbilly out of the hills, but you can't take the hills out of the hillbilly. Tim, thanks so much, and have a great evening.
Appreciate you, Bob.
Bye. Timothy Kuntz, trial lawyer extraordinaire, in what I hope you enjoyed as much as I did in terms of getting what I hope is a little bit different understanding of what has been turned into, of course, a media circus. I would, you know what, for all intents and purposes, that is as good as, well, that's better than most anything that's been offered in the for-profit media. Just plain and simple. Now, we're going to take a break, and before we do that, I want to tender thanks to Sal. Thanks to Sal, we are now down to $230 that we need to raise to get us into the black as we close this week and head toward the middle of July. Thank you very kindly. You know the number if you want to call in, 304-658-3333. The Skype line is open. Bob Kincaid Horn on Skype. This is, as you have just witnessed for the last hour and 15 minutes, this is Conversation Radio. We'll be back. you're such a great lawyer in conversation, such as what Timothy Coons just brought us, how could you not play the drive-by truckers that wig he made her wear? This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid. It's Friday on the front porch. We're going to go straight to the conversation in just a moment, but I got to share this with you because in the note that Mark sent along from San Francisco, he included a story. And by the way, he also said, in regard to Timothy, my conversation with Timothy Coons, I hope Cassie in Princeton is listening to this conversation. Me too, or maybe that she'll get the podcast. It might be beneficial to hear a description. You know, granted, former Supreme Court Justice, now dead guy, Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. Had a coke problem and had some pretty ugly authoritarian rulings, but along the way he said something, and he said something that about the lawyering art. They call it a profession; it's an art. I think listening to Timothy Coons, you can tell it's an art. Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. said, "It is possible to live greatly in the law." And it is beneficial in an era of more pettifoggers than lawyers to hear from somebody like Tim Coons and know that there are people out there living greatly in the law, because he is. He's the kind of guy you'd want in your corner. But anyway, Mark continues and says, the article I've linked to here is about a local journalist, read Talking Newshead, and the horrible mistake that slipped through the hard-hitting journalists of our local Fox affiliate in San Francisco. This is an excellent demonstration of why the Horn family is so important. The story has to do with the coverage in San Francisco by KTVU, the Fox affiliate, in the aftermath of the Asiana Airlines crash, in which another individual has just died, or from which. During the noon newscast Friday, you know, the noon news, there's happy talk and, you know, what you can find in your local farmer's market, you know, that kind of, you know, stuff. But the story says, during the noon newscast Friday, co-anchor Tori Campbell, hard-hitting journalist. Now, understand, this is how KTVU, Fox News, builds itself. You know, they trumpeted the fact that they were first on air, first online, first with alerts to mobile devices, first on Twitter and Facebook, first with aerial shots from KTVU News Chopper, KTVU News Chopper 2, Action Team Witness News Team coverage. First with a live reporter from the scene, first live interview with anyone connected to someone on the flight. First. Well, they were also very proud of being, because this is the way for-profit media, so-called journalism works. You know, you got to be first past the post, and then you tell them what you're going to do. You tell them what you're doing, and then you tell them what you did. And we were first at it. Team Action Eyewitness News Coverage 5. 2. Hike. So Tori Campbell goes on the air and announces, KTVU has just learned the names. You know, it's all breathless. Remember, it's Fox. KTVU has just learned the names of the four pilots who were on board Asiana Flight 214, and then starts reading the teleprompter and doesn't have enough brains to know that she is being had in a big way. And she reads the four names of the pilots of Asiana Flight 214. Comes up on the teleprompter, and the four pilots of Asiana Flight 214 were Captain Sum Ting Wong. Now, at that point in time, even if you're just a talking head newsreader for KTVU Action News Eyewitness Team Coverage 2, when you see Captain Sum Ting Wong, it's probably a pretty good bet you should shut up and say, and it appears we're having technical problems with that. Next story, please. But no, not co-anchor Tori Campbell of KTVU Team News Action Coverage Witness 2, Fox. No. She's got her foot in it, and she's going to push it in a little harder till the stinky hits her kneecaps. Let's see. The pilot was Captain Sumting Wong, and then also there was Wee Too Low, Holy Fuck, and Bang Ding Ow. Then they go to break. Then they go to break. Thank you, Mark, for sending this along. There's no, I am not aware of a better example of why anyone who gets their news from the television ain't getting no news. You're getting crap that's packaged in between the laundry soap commercials with stain blockers. So they come back from a break, and Action Team News Witness Coverage 2, KTVU, San Francisco, Fox, co-anchor Tori Campbell says, obviously, those were not the real names of the crew on board Asiana 214. But we confirmed them earlier with the National Transportation Safety Board. You know what? I think you're lying, Tori. And even if you're not lying, I think you and the people upstream from you are idiots. Because even assuming for a moment that the NTSB said that to you, which they didn't, they're very businesslike, the NTSB, then it's probably a pretty good guess that there's a news director who should have caught that. A producer, even. Maybe the person who was inputting it into the font machine, the graphics generator. Somebody. Anybody. Captain Sumting Wong. God almighty. Thank you so much, Mark, for sending that story along. Let's see what this actually sounds like, because, you know, I do funny voices and stuff, but if you want to hear stupid, you want to hear Fox, right? Yeah. Thanks, Isaac, for sending the audio.
We have new information now also on the plane crash. KTVU has just learned the names of the four pilots who were on board the flight. They are Captain Sumting Wong, Wee Too Low, Ho Lee Fook, and Bang Ding Ow. In the NTSB.
Fox News. We report. You decide if we're idiots. Jeebus. So, what was that, today? This is Friday. God almighty. So, I just wanted to make sure you guys got that story. Holy cow. Let's go to the phones. They are all lighted up. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hello?
Hello, Edward.
Yes. I just wanted to tell you how much I enjoyed this program this evening, being a retired law librarian.
Ah, that's true, that's true.
Yeah, 30 years ago, I was president of the Dallas Association of Law Librarians, long ago and far, far away.
I'll be darned. That's, yes. And you know what, that's a, that is an arcane business, to say the very least, is it not?
You're telling me. Well, anyway, I got some news today. I didn't know whether you heard it or not, about our one and only governor of the Lone Star State, Rick Perry.
He of the good hair.
Yes, of good hair. Thank you, Molly Ivins. She's the one named him that.
Oh, yes, she is.
Oh, yeah.
Devoutly to be missed.
Yes, tell me. Anyway, Rick Perry is traveling this fall to Israel to bring together the Arabs, Christians, and Jews.
Stop it. Okay, I mean,
no,
you've told us a lot of funny things on the air, Edward. But I mean, there are limits to funning.
No, it's the truth. I mean, it is.
Well, I guess it's possible. He may be so loathsome to both Arab and Jew alike that they will come together and realize that if they can agree that he's a loathsome, miserable, misanthropic excuse for a member of the human race, that maybe there's hope for them too.
I started yelling, "Oh, Aunt Pitty Pat, please bring me my smelling salts."
Get me the smelling salts. Yes.
Oh, Lord, help me, Jesus, through the night. Well, anyway, I'll let you go. I just wanted to drop that little bomb.
Well, Edward, I'm so glad you did. I mean, shalom, y'all.
Yeah.
Shalom alaikum.
Mazel tov and all that.
Now, when's he going to do this?
This fall. He may change his mind. I hope he does. Because, you know, those people over there think we're crazy anyway.
You know, I maybe he's going to go missionary to them.
Oh, my. No, he wouldn't. He makes too much money where he is. Oh, Lord, he's just rolling in the shekels or whatever.
The dinars.
Yeah.
how many? Right, exactly.
Well, you all take care and have a good weekend.
You have a lovely weekend, Edward.
Thank you very much.
Bye now. No. Oh, God. It's probably true. Onward. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, how's it going, Bob?
Good, good, good.
This is Dave from Portland.
Yeah, hey, Dave.
How are you?
I'm getting by.
That was a hilarious story about Fox. I stopped watching TV a long time ago. It's been years that even watch. I mean, I still have a TV, but I don't watch it ever. And I have cable to get the internet, but they won't let you get TV. You know, they won't let you get internet with TV. Such a, you know, a Comcast for you.
But you know, the funny thing is, it wasn't just that she was reading off the teleprompter, as I saw from what Isaac sent along. Dave, it was up on the screen too in print. As she read it to the KTVU News Channel Action 2 Team Eyewitness Coverage Fox audience, who, you know, the ones who are, you know, she reads, there are those who can't read the TV and there are those who can't hear the TV, so you put it up there for both.
Right.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
My favorite part of the story, Dave, I didn't actually read, calls to news director Schmuckenstein were not returned. He was probably too desperate clinging to his job.
Yeah. When I stopped watching TV, I really was just so disgusted by everything I was seeing. Actually, you know, it's really funny. I used to have a little hot dog stand downtown, and the weatherman from NBC was downtown. I met up with him. This was about 10 years ago, and I had met up with him, and I said, "Oh, his name is Bruce Sussman." I said, "Hey, Bruce Sussman, the only truth I ever hear on the news, you know, the weather." You know, it was funny, but I lost faith in the TV media a long, long time ago. Where I get most of my news, actually, I used to go to the Huffington Post a lot, but I go to Reddit a lot now. I like Reddit.
Yeah, Reddit, and what's the other one?
I don't know. You tell me.
Oh, I can't remember now, but there's Reddit, and there's and for technical stuff, Ars Technica, and...
Yeah. I check a number of sites, actually, for news. Like, I go to the LA Times, because I was born and raised down there, down south, in Los Angeles. And
well, I try to read as much as I can that's not behind a paywall, but if you go to the New York Times too often, they'll put up that very threatening box at the corner saying, "You have read 10 out of the 12 articles you're allowed to read this month, you godforsaken deadbeat."
Yeah, they do that on the LA Times too. You get a limit of articles, so I'll just peruse the headlines and see if there's anything interesting.
Yeah, and sometimes sometimes you don't mean to, and you click stuff, and I'll do that, and I'll go, "Holy cow! I didn't want to hear about read about Fashion Week in Bratislava."
Yeah, that's right. Right. Well, it all depends. But I hit RT, and I hit a number of sites that have. I hit Guardian now. I'm Guardian. every once in a while, just to see if there's anything going on. But a lot of times I'll just listen to the internet radio and then check a headline or something like that. But Reddit seems to be the best conduit for me for news. I just enjoy the news. It's like environmental stories. They have pages and pages and pages of environmental stories. Go to one site and they've got one story or, two stories or something. There's so little coverage on the environment. It's just disgusting. How's the weather been out there?
It really hasn't been weather so much as just monsoon season. It's a temperate monsoon season. It rains every day now. Everywhere you step, it squishes. Only it's, 85 and 90 degrees at the same time. And, yes, I realize that there's a significant portion of the country going, 85 or 90 degrees? I'd kill for 85 or 90 degrees. But it's 85 or 90 degrees, with 98% humidity. And you feel like, just walking from here to here to the car that you probably ought to be doing the breaststroke.
That sounds rough. That really sounds rough. I know. I don't want to say what it's like here. It's just been really nice here. Sorry.
Oh, rub it in, sure.
One of
these days, there's two things. There's a couple of things I want to see. I want to see the Great Northwest in the summer, and I want to see Northern Wisconsin in the summer.
Yeah. Pacific Northwest. I would just say this: Seattle's a lot different than going to Portland. I've been to Seattle a number of times, and it's just a really stressful town to drive around in. And over here in Portland, we have a much better transit system. It's a lot more walkable. They put these speed bumps on the side roads, on these long side streets, so that you can't go over about 20 miles an hour to make it like a bike route. And it's amazing how many people ride. I was out late last night. I was driving home from the western suburbs. I have a friend who lives out in Beaverton, which is sort of suburbs. But I was driving back, and I couldn't believe there were, I kept seeing bike riders on the road at, midnight. But the weather, the weather's not cold or rainy, so it's just been, bike riding weather. But I was seeing bike riders all over late at night, too. It's just like, this is really a friendly, bike-friendly town, and they've designed it as such. And it's like they have a counter on we have a bunch of bridges. We have two rivers that run through town. We got a river that runs, only river west of the Mississippi that runs south to north, which is Willamette, runs into the Columbia, which runs east to west. But the Willamette goes through the middle of downtown Portland, and I live across the Hawthorne Bridge. So the Hawthorne Bridge has a counter, though, which counts the number of bicycles going over the bridge. And I ride over sometimes to downtown, and there's 2,000 bikes riding over the bridge. It's amazing. It's really, really amazing. But, been very, very, very temperate here. Actually kind of cool. It's like in the 70s today. Unbelievably mild. We had a little hot weather, but it's gotten really, really nice.
It sounds lovely.
Yeah, you got to come out and visit us sometime. Because I know, with the coal trains and everything, people are up in arms about that. You can share your experience with the gold dust and everything.
Hey, I'll go anywhere I'm invited.
Yeah. I'll have to talk to some friends, some activist friends with SEIU or something to get you out here and speak on that. Cause, people are concerned about it. But how about that revolution over there in Egypt? I was really flabbergasted. I was listening to something on the radio. Pacifica. We have a Pacifica station here in KBOO, and they were talking about how there were 30 million people in the streets over there in Egypt right before Morsi fell. That is amazing to me. Out of a population of 80, we had 30 million people in the streets. Can you imagine that? That is insane. That's unbelievable.
What is that, Dave, as a percentage of the Egyptian population?
It's at 37.5. I think 3/8.
Yeah. I thought it was. I thought it was a pretty pretty high number.
Yeah. I mean, could you imagine?
That's 99. That's 90. That's in excess of 99 million Americans in the streets.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking to myself. The same thing. I was just thinking, here in Portland, we got
you have about 1 million people in the metro area, that'd be like 335,000 people in the street. There's no way that, I mean, they didn't have a coup over there. The military said, we can't handle this. You got to get rid of this guy, you know what I mean? It was just like, I'm sure they just said, enough of this.
Yeah, the problem, though, is, I've tried to read as much as I can, Dave, about the situation in Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a little tough to get a handle on.
Yes.
And there's something in me, and I think it's in the way of my peaceful, nonviolent insistence that war is not the answer, that worries more than a little bit any time the military decides that it knows better than a democratically elected government what's good for the people.
Right.
And essentially that's what's happened here.
Right.
Because, I mean, for instance, back in the early 1950s, the United States covert ops folks, you know, the fledgling CIA, decided that it knew better than the people of Iran what kind of government it should have after Iran had elected a man by the name of Mohammad Mossadegh to be their prime minister. And so we, the United States, staged a military coup to overturn the democratically elected government of Mossadegh and replace it with a preening jackass by the name of Reza Pahlavi, who was then placed upon the so-called peacock throne and became the Shah, and created the Savik, who went about brutalizing people who didn't think that the Shah was the neatest thing since sliced bread.
Right, right.
And in fact, it would only take a generation or so, but then that would in turn, you know, United States meddling in other people's business would in turn give rise to the Iranian Revolution, the hostage crisis, and I'm not sure if it's more direct or indirectly, the presidency of Ronald Wilson Reagan.
Absolutely. But here's where I think it's a little different over there in Egypt. I think the people are pretty seasoned and they're pretty cynical and they're pretty worldly about governments, and they had their own version in whatever his name was, Musharraf or what, not in the Musharraf, was that it? Hosni, yeah.
Mubarak.
Mubarak, right. Mubarak. They had their own version of that, and they kicked his butt out, and I think it was really healthy to see them reassert themselves, the people, that is, and I believe that, you know, the best governments probably are the governments that fear their people, that respect their people. I mean, respect is fear on that level, and I think that the end, the story remains to be finished and told, but overall, I see it as sort of a positive move, because I just believe that the people are showing that they can mobilize enough populace to overwhelm any kind of governmental or military force or anything else. But 30 million people, that's truly significant. There's no way that it's like the French Revolution. They had mobilized so many people out there that they had to do it right by the people eventually after, you know, years and years of blood and suffering. But still in all, I mean, they moved to a government which served them very well for centuries, I think, with interludes of problems, but we don't live in a perfect world. I just see it as a positive thing, because I think that Morsi was, or whatever his name was, Morsi, was made a lot of promises he had no intention of keeping. The guy was a fundamentalist, and people didn't have anything. And I listened to NPR because I don't have a choice sometimes in the car, and they were just talking about how people are just wild because, you know, they can get gas now. They can go to the store and get a quart of milk or something. You know, they can buy the things they need, whereas under Morsi they couldn't even do that. So it's kind of it sounds to me like the whoever's in charge over there is responding to the will of the expressed will of the people, at least at this point in time, and I hope it continues, but it just sounds like it's a much more positive direction than it was under this guy. And he was wanting to you know, institute a fundamentalist regime again, like the Iranians, which the Iranians hate the regime that they've got there, but they've got such a stranglehold on everything now that, and they tried to shake it off, but you know, the people in Egypt were just in the mood, shall we say. That was a Glenn Miller song, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yes, indeed.
But I just saw that as kind of a positive thing, and I'm glad it happened. But yeah, everything going on, I think that the last time we talked, I was talking about how the LA just has to get up to a certain level in a populace, I suppose, for people to just get really sick of it, shake it off, or you know, in that case, I think it's healthy.
Well, the thing with Egypt. And this, look, it's time for a boring reference to classical antiquity with Bob. The thing with Egypt is that it has always, Egypt's fate has always risen or fallen on the ability of whoever is in control in Egypt to simply provide daily bread to the people of Egypt.
Right.
It was that way under the various dynasties of pharaohs, to the point that one of the earliest technological innovations that the Egyptians came up with was something called a nilometer.
What is that?
It was a device or a structure, I guess would be the better way to put it, toward the headwaters of the Nile,
mm-hmm.
or way up the Nile at the very least, probably around... Is it Elephantine Island? Where the Nile surges and the quality of the flooding determined whether or not the Egyptian people starved or ate.
Right.
And somebody eventually figured out that you could measure the waters as they rose at the upper end of the Nile and tell whether or not the inundation would be sufficient to grow the crops that would keep the people eating. So that and that's what the nilometer did. There were the I think they were called the cubits of. There was a mark on the wall of the nilometer for the cubits of plenty.
What's a cubit? Remember Bill Cosby?
Yeah, exactly. What's a cubit? Yeah. How long can you tread water? But there were the cubits of plenty, and the cubits of sufficiency. And the cubits of famine, and then way Uh-oh. Down at the bottom were the cubits of death.
Uh-oh. Yeah, that's the cubits of the intermediate period.
Right.
Like that. Yeah. I studied a lot of Egyptian history, too. When I was a kid, I was about 16, the treasures of Tutankhamun came to L.A. when I was living there when I was a kid, and I got to see all that, and then I started getting interested in it, and I studied a lot, and I have a couple of years of art history, so we studied Egyptian history a lot in art history, and I know about, you know, their dynasties. They had, like, the Old Kingdom, and then they would have an intermediate period, which was...
And the Middle Kingdom and the New Kingdom. And
right, these intermediate periods between the kingdoms, between the middle and old, middle and new, because that would be the time when political instability... And famine and pretty much anarchy, and then things together again.
It's hard for any child of an inquiring mind or an inquiring nature, having been exposed to the wonders of ancient Egypt, not to be absolutely drawn in by them. The same thing happened to me. I've referenced it on a number of occasions. As a child, I ran across a copy of a quite dense book called God's Graves and Scholars. And it literally changed the course of my future.
Yeah, yeah.
And the fact that I'm 50 years old sitting here talking about a book that I thumbed through and doped out what words I could on the photo plates, the black and white photo plates in the middle, as a 3-year-old, are testament to that. I will never forget, I just sat there staring at it. There was a photograph of the unwrapped head of Ramses II, the mighty Ramses II. Just
completely. Yeah, he was kind of skinny, wasn't he?
Yeah, and he apparently died miserable because he had bad teeth.
Yeah, well, he was inbred. All those
traded some mutts in the line.
That's right. That's right. And that's you need genetic diversity. And I know that they would all marry their sisters, and they were into that. They'd try to keep the power and the family.
Yeah, such that tradition intermingled with some Macedonian traditions, and that's, you know, the last pharaoh of Egypt was, of course, an import, and her name was Cleopatra the VII. And she was to be married up to Ptolemy, her brother. Unfortunately, neither of the two could stand the other, and Cleopatra won that fight with the help of a wandering Roman by the name of Gaius Caesar.
Ah, yes, that's it. That's how it went down. Yeah, I remember. I vaguely remember. I think there was a movie about it, wasn't there? Back in the 60s?
Yeah, Elizabeth Taylor, Richard Burton.
Oh, yeah, that's it. Yeah.
Rex Harrison as Caesar.
I've got to look that up on YouTube one of these days.
Oh, it's a fun watch. It's a little bit silly, but it's a fun watch. Now, it's a little closer to what we understand from the ancient sources. If you look to the HBO series of the early part of this century, simply entitled Rome, and it takes in the whole Caesar, Mark Antony, Cleopatra thing quite nicely.
Yeah, they had an incredible culture, though. And they really, a part of it was they were surrounded by desert, so they were protected. It wasn't like Mesopotamia or something that was vulnerable to attack. Any army would have to cross a huge desert before they could attack.
Well, or come in from the sea, or come in from the Levant. One of the seminal historical moments in Egypt's ancient history is the attack of the people who are simply referred to in the texts as the Hyksos, Hyksos.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, it's all well. See how easy it is to geek out on this stuff.
Yeah, it's great stuff. It's fun stuff.
And so when I see what's and it's just the way I am, Dave. When I see what's going on in Egypt today, I think about the Egypt of former millennia, and not much has changed. If you cannot feed the people, you cannot rule the country.
Yeah, that's a basic fact. Well, I think that goes down everywhere. I believe. I think they've got a lot of water insecurity over there in the Middle East, and so that's what's driving a lot of these revolutions too. And they're just it's not working for the people because they're just monopolizing all the wealth and not giving anything to people. And I don't know. People don't have much. They don't have much to lose by taking actions like that, you know.
Yeah.
But.
No, go. No, please.
I just I wonder sometimes what it's going to take over here. But it seems like
it will take the inexorable force of time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's going down other places too, in Brazil and. You know, we never even hear about the news in so many other countries. I was at a friend of mine's house last night. I was staying over in Beaverton, and she's trying to rescue this person who's in India. And this woman she's an American, and she's in India, and she's got a bad case of a chemical sensitivity. You know what that is?
Yes.
That's all about. I'm sure you get a lot of it over there, I bet. Do you not?
To one degree or another, yes. But I suspect your friend's friend has probably got something even more profound.
Yeah, it's an autoimmune thing, and people just go nuts over it. They can't do anything. They lose all their energy. They're just debilitated. It's a really debilitating thing, and it's largely, I'm sure, because of all this industrial pollution. But she's over there in India, and she's got very little money, and my friend is trying to raise money over here. She met this person through some other people who are into chemical sensitivity, and she's trying to help this person get back to the United States, talking to the U.S. consulate, and she was talking to this British national that's managing this building that's over there in India. Oh, God, it's off in some remote village somewhere, too. It was just unbelievable conversation. I was listening to this thing on a conference call last night, and just marveling at it all. But a lot of these folks that have the chemical sensitivity, I think, they also have there's a psychological facet to it. If you know what I'm saying, it's kind of they're excitable, maybe not so great word is neurotic type personalities. So they get upset and excited, and there's a psychosomatic component to it all. I don't understand it fully, but it sounds a lot like my friend is very she's a brilliant person, but she's very excitable too. And so she'll get upset and, you know, I told her a couple of times, just calm down. But she was calling all these people. She was calling the American Council over there in India. And, oh, God, it was unbelievable. I was at her house until about midnight last night. It was an exciting international tour, shall we say, in conversations with all these different people. But she's trying to get the American representative over there to help her with this situation, and she's calling a congressperson, and she's this friend of mine over here, she's just stirring up the coals, trying to put a lot of heat on people to help this person to get home, because she's kind of stuck over there. Can you imagine that? Could you imagine being over there and stuff?
And she actually knows this person?
She has never met the person face-to-face. That's the thing. And she has never met this person face-to-face, but she knows her through these other people who are, they have sort of a, you know, they network, these people with chemical sensitivity. And so she's met this woman through them, and she's gotten some donations from some other people that are involved in the kind of community that they have. And, it's fairly widespread though, and it hasn't been accepted that long as a disorder, but I do believe it is, because of all the pollution and also reading something else about how these GMOs have detrimental effects on people's digestive tracts, and they get things like Crohn's disease and colitis and all these other horrible things that are partly autoimmune, partly environmental. It sounds just like a nightmare. But it's happening to more and more people, and the medical authorities are having to take note and acknowledge it as an actual disorder. So thankfully I'm not suffering from it yet. And it happens a lot to women, you know. A lot of women get it, and because I think they have more sensitive metabolism and more sensitive systems, and so they fall prey to it a lot. And it's like lupus, a lot of autoimmune disorders. I know another girl who's about a few years younger than me, and she's had real problems with autoimmune disorder too. And it's really pretty here in Oregon. A lot of trees and stuff, but there's also a lot of environmental garbage here too. The rivers are dirty as hell, and I was telling you about the Willamette River. We have a part of the Willamette that's like closer to the Columbia, where all the shipping comes in, and they have one of the biggest grain terminals. Actually, maybe you're the one that told me that they have the biggest grain terminal on the West Coast over here.
That wasn't me.
Okay, well, somebody was telling me that just recently, and somebody in the know, and they said that we have one of the largest, if not the largest, grain terminal on the West Coast here, because just. It's called the Portland Harbor, though. It's the northern end of the Willamette River running into Columbia, and it's like a Superfund site. There's PCBs and all kinds of really horrible stuff in the sediment in the water there, because they were just, you know, in the 60s it was just a toilet bowl down there, and they were pouring a lot of untreated sewage into the rivers, and it was quite nasty, but it's been cleaned up quite a bit. They're tearing up the whole. I live on the east side of the Willamette, which is east side of town, and they're tearing up all of the streets here and putting in new sewage pipes so it doesn't overflow when we have a heavy quick rainfall. You know, you know, all the stuff goes to treatment now too. It's not like in the 40s and the 50s when it was just going raw into the river systems, but it's a long process cleaning up. I think that's got to be the goal of the next regime or the next decades in the future. We got to get all this mess cleaned up.
Well, I think there's a general understanding that needs to be deeply digested all over this country, Dave, that we're all over, literally all over the country, swimming in, breathing in, walking in, living in poison.
Yeah.
And of course, every last bit of that poison, at somewhere along the way, has meant a profit for some corporation.
Right.
And until we come to that very, very essential understanding, well.
We're just shitting in our bed. That's all we're doing. We gotta get it. We gotta stop it. We gotta just clean it out. I mean, I know that it, when I think of all the wasteland in this world, I know reclaiming all this, it's gonna have to be worth it at some point. You know, we're running out of clean water. We're running out of clean land. We're running out of these things. And it's just, I don't know. I'm just living from day to day, hoping that we're just in this. I think we're in a transition period right now, really. It's sort of an intermediate period, and I'm always comforted to know that renewables are just increasing more and more. I always talk about this, and it's just like I heard that renewables, solar, increased like 25% down in California last year, in 2012. And that's awesome. We just got to keep doing that, just increasing it. And the people that are holding back, eventually they'll just have to fall in line too with it. Because it's going to make energy so cheap that I think that's the real way to.
Yeah, no, hold on. I don't think energy's ever going to be cheap. America was promised that if they just built enough nuclear power plants back in the 50s, that energy would be almost free.
Well,
that worked out how? And look, you know, nobody's going to get into wind turbine business or the solar business or the geothermal business so that they can continue sweating the mortgage every month. As long as the system we have remains in place, Dave, it will always be a matter of maximizing profit over the needs of the people.
Oh, absolutely. But I think that, you know, a lot of times, a lot of these issues that I think we tend to really stress a lot about, they just can't get the government to do the right thing or the people in power to do the right thing. I think people have to take matters in their own hands and their own individual lives. And somebody, you know, wherever they are, if they can get a solarize their house and get off the grid, I think it's got double the benefits, because not only they fixed in their price of their energy for the next however long that system lasts, but also they are not giving money to these people who are destroying the planet and this primitive technology that's like, I mean, you know, stone knives and bear skins anyway, hey, I know you're a big Star Trek fan, right?
I've watched a few episodes.
I know you're a huge Star Trek fan.
But I'm choosy. Now I'm going to get hate mail over this. I never became a really hardcore Deep Space Nine guy.
I actually, you know, when I was a small child, this was when Star Trek was on the air. I was never a big Star Trek fan because of the fact that I was hugely into Lost in Space, which was up against. I mean, Star Trek. They put Star Trek up against Lost in Space because it was a big hit. I was into Danger, Will Robinson. I loved, you know, Dr. Smith one time at the grocery store. We had a Piggly Wiggly on our corner, and Dr. Smith was in his car, and he was driving, and I was in terror seeing this guy. Talk about, oh, terror. I saw him, and I went, oh, my God, it's Dr. Smith. You know, where's the robot? About 6 years old. But,
you miserable bucket of bolts. Yes. Yeah, the only one I could never really stomach was Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea, because that was apparently the shabbiest, flimsiest damn submarine that had ever been built. I mean, if it ran across a kelp bed, it was all over.
Yeah, it was listing and back and forth, and they always had the scenes where I was okay with Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea. The flying sub was really cool. But back to Star Trek. I have to tell you this. I never met Shatner. I never met Nimoy or anything like that. I mean, I would have been flabbergasted. I got into them as a teenager. Got into the to Star Trek as a teenager, but a friend of mine, and I grew up in Los Angeles, and a friend of mine's dad actually wrote one of the Star Treks. I have to tell you this. You remember the one where they're being pulled into the giant amoeba, and at the end, Kirk...
Yeah, exactly. And is that the one that looked like a cornucopia? William Wyndham kamikaze'd his starship into the mouth of it after he'd gone insane.
No, that was the Planet Eater. You're thinking of the Planet Eater, I think. No, you're thinking of the Planet Eater. This was where they're being pulled into the amoeba, and Kirk goes in like the shuttlecraft into the amoeba and goes in and puts like antimatter into the chromosome, kills the amoeba.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah, it was not one of the greatest Star Treks, but my best friend in 11th grade, his dad had written this. It's kind of a washed-up screenwriter when I knew him, and this was in the mid-70s, 77 I knew him, and he was a bit washed up by that time, but he had written that Star Trek. And another one, my other closest connection to Star Trek was that you remember this one where they had this interstellar war with the Klingons, and it's like they would have these signature casts in some of the Star Treks. It was like Kirk and Spock beam to the planet's surface, and everybody's kind of oblivious to them. And they go into the town council or the city council, and they're all these very, very peaceful people. And then the Klingons come in, and they're having this kind of little covert war. The Klingons, but it's like an interstellar war, but they're having this little war on the planet's surface. Remember that episode? Okay. The guy that was the head of that council, like the Council of the Elders that was on the planet's surface, he was a character actor by the name of Dean Okutashi, and he was the husband of a close friend of my mom's. It cracked me up.
Awesome. And I guess that happens growing up in Southern California.
Yeah, it does. I was more impressed. Yeah, I was over at their house one day, and I was more impressed by this. I was sitting at their house, and I'm looking at the wall, and they had these kind of childlike pastel pictures on the wall that were drawn on newsprint. And I was looking at them, and it says, "To David from Mark." And I'm looking at these pictures, and I'm going, "Oh, my God. This guy's buddy was Mark Chagall." So I was going, "Whoa, hey!" He got around. He had that kind of imperious voice, you know. That character actor that was the head of the David Okutashi. He had this kind of imperious voice and this look of like a Roman patrician or something like that. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I think what's the word for that kind of voice? Stentorian. Yeah.
Yeah. Whatever it was. It was a funny thing. I'd like to share those stories with people, though, before I check out in life. That was my closest encounter with Star Trek. When actually, you know, those guys, they all live down there. I think they all still do. And Shatner's a huge star. I mean, he was at it for years before Star Trek. And how many shows since. But he's got that melodramatic, over dramatic, campy kind of style he's a real entertainer. I like Shatner a lot. But I never met him. If I ever did get to meet the guy, I would be
the most enjoyable guy to follow on Facebook now is George.
Oh, George.
Guy. Yeah. Hey Dave, I got a roll. We got blinking lights here. But
okay,
hopefully we will talk again soon.
Yeah, talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye now, Dave. Dave calling from Portland. Always a pleasant conversation. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, it's Juanita.
Well, hey, Juanita, how are you?
Oh, I'm trying to make it, Bob. How are you and the beautiful Agnes?
The beautiful Agnes is not feeling so beautiful right now because she has caught what I had. As for me, I'm trying to get over what I had, and
what
I'm not there
is that
yet.
Going around?
Whatever it is, I hate it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not enough to put you all the way into bed, but it's about from the clavicle up and just coughing and your eyes watering. It's not allergies.
That's
it's
it.
Some sort of damn bug, and it's just slaying me.
Oh, yeah. Well, Bob, I'm going to talk about Zimmerman.
Okay.
And
that's appropriate, given the amount of time that Mr. Coons and I spoke.
Well, you know, I think it sort of boils down to whether or not the jury will think that Trayvon Martin deserves justice, and is he human enough to deserve justice? Now, this is kind of what African Americans go through in the judicial system. The whole thing is, are you human? Do you deserve the same rights? Do you deserve justice? I spent 11 years, I used to work for a bank, I've mentioned this on your show before, and my job for 11 years was going to court as a court liaison for a bank. So I saw the judicial system here in Columbus, Ohio, from a layman's point of view. I'm not a lawyer. And so I, you know, would be subpoenaed to, you know, municipal, common pleas, federal court, you name it. Domestic relations, I got an education that, you know, that of the judicial system that few people really are, would be, you know, would be able to even understand. And I saw things that, well, there's so much discrimination. And it's not just black, white. You know, what you look like physically has a lot the way you can be treated in a court of law. You know, if you're an attractive person, you may not receive as, you know, as a matter of fact, I was in a courtroom and a judge made the statement that this woman, particular woman that was on trial or charged with a crime, was too pretty to put in jail. You know. But I would like to also say there's one particular case that stands out that I remember. It involved a man who was put away for 5 years for being a serial rapist. His name was William Jackson. Well, it turned out that William Jackson did not commit the crime. It was a doctor, a prominent African-American doctor, and his last name happened to be Jackson. And William Jackson appeared on 60 Minutes. This was sometime in the 80s. And he was talking about, you know, what he went through, you know, being in prison and being accused of a crime he didn't do. He was stabbed and so forth. That following Monday, I was sitting in court waiting for court to begin, and there was a criminal defense lawyer, there was a prosecutor, and there was a couple of deputy sheriffs, and they were discussing the case. And it was interesting listening to these men try to justify Mr. Jackson spending 5 years of his life in prison for something that he didn't do. And basically what they did was dehumanize him. And they said things like, well, he was accused of a robbery 10 years ago. That woman that was on with him, that wasn't his wife at the time. They were common law. And they kept naming these things that try to make it appear as though what happened to him should have happened anyway because he was no good. And so I'm kind of seeing that same thing with Trayvon Martin, where they are trying to say that this kid And because he's black, he doesn't deserve, he's not fully human. You know, he's up to no good. He doesn't deserve justice. You know, even though he's the victim, he still doesn't deserve justice. And I disagree with your guess about, I think the prosecution did do a good job of what I saw of it, and I must admit I didn't watch it all. However, I thought the defense for Zimmerman, they interjected race when they could. Now, today in the closing remarks, they put up a shirtless photograph of Trayvon Martin. They said it was to show his muscle mass. That the purpose of that was to show the jury, who were white females, the scary black teenager, shirtless, you know, and to stare.
You know, there are so many levels of stereotype with that, Juanita, that I can scarcely begin to. because I mean, let's see, we're going to show them the scary young black male, shirtless. Mm-hmm. Or, and I'm not trying to be crass, but merely to acknowledge the existence of an existing trope within terrified white America.
Right.
They're going to show the muscular young buck to the white ladies.
Yep.
And you know, trigger what? But it's certainly a trigger, right?
Right. Well, to me, he looked like a skinny teenager. I mean, and the photograph. Maybe I'm looking at it a different way. I didn't see much muscle. You know, to me,
I saw for the first time today, Juanita, and I found it horrifying. I found something that the for-profit media have, to the best of my knowledge, largely kept away from the viewing audience. I saw the photograph that the jury saw.
Oh, really?
Of Trayvon Martin lying dead.
Really?
Yeah, he's got a hoodie on. The hood is off. You can see the bullet holes. Not a lot of blood. Just
right.
nine millimeter bullet holes, I think. He's lying on the grass. The grass doesn't look like it's been trampled in some sort of struggle for life.
Mm-hmm.
Then.
Mm-hmm.
One, the cuffs of his, and he was wearing skinny jeans.
Yeah.
And the cuffs of his skinny jeans are rolled once, and so you can see the space between his the top of his shoe and the beginning of the jeans, you know, roughly his ankles.
Mm-hmm.
His head is thrown back and his eyes are still open.
Yeah.
And I just...
Yeah.
I mean...
And Zimmerman, you know, the guest, Mr. Kuntz, when he was talking about Zimmerman having a previous history of the domestic violence and the beating up of the cop was just a couple of them.
No. Yeah, he had a history, Jim pointed out. There. But the thing is, that can't come in. It cannot come in as part of the prosecution's case in chief. And
right.
That is, as Tim explained, why, at least in part, his lawyers had to counsel him against taking the stand. Because had he taken the stand, then in the form of rebuttal, every last one of those incidents would have come in.
Yeah. But the media, the way they are doing the packed media type thing, where they're all saying the same thing, and they all kind of, well, the prosecution didn't do a good job in proving his case. Gloria Allred's daughter is...
Oh, dear God. I was hoping we were going to get through the night without mention of Gloria Allred.
Her daughter, Lisa Bloom, is the And she keeps saying, well, they didn't prove their case, the prosecution.
You know, she needs to shut up, and so do all these so-called expert lawyers, because there are only six people on planet Earth who can make the determination as to whether or not the prosecution proved its case. And they sat in the jury box.
From what I saw, I thought they did an excellent job. And I thought they would not, being from Florida. I admit I have issues about Florida and the Stand Your Ground law, which it really, Bob, if you've read, though, and I'm sure you have, some of those old slave code, black code laws, back during slavery, that Stand Your Ground thing sounds exactly like some of that stuff. Because back at that time, African Americans, basically all of your life was criminalized. You couldn't stand on the street. You couldn't carry a cane. You couldn't carry a stick. You couldn't have a dog in some places, because all these were perceived as weapons. And, of course, the remedy, if you did not comply, was to shoot to kill.
Well, sure, and for those who aren't intimately familiar with the old Jim Crow South, you know, there are things like the eyeball rule and the step-off rule.
Right,
You know, the eyeball rule is what got Emmett Till murdered.
Exactly. Yeah.
But, you know,
I think they call it reckless eyeballing.
But, you know, you're raising these kind of, this is off the topic of the Zimmerman trial, but you've touched on something that reminded me of something else. You know what went on in Texas today, right?
No, I don't.
Because
I had a doctor's appointment, and I was out for most of the day.
Well, because of the gut-bending fear of the Republicans in Texas, every woman seeking admission to the gallery of the legislature was forced to submit to a search of her person and her bag.
You're kidding.
Well, we haven't gotten to the good part yet, Juanita. Every tampon.
Oh, no.
Every sanitary napkin.
Oh, no.
Was confiscated.
You've got to be kidding.
No, ma'am. No, ma'am. Now, meanwhile, it remained quite legal for people to bring guns.
Well, what did they think that the woman was going to do? Poke them with a tampon or something?
Or I don't know. You know, throw them.
Oh, God. Terrible.
It's
terrible.
And if a woman would not give up her feminine hygiene products, she would not be allowed into the people's chamber.
Oh. Well, I still say, Bob, and I mentioned this to you before, I don't understand, and I don't know what's legal, but I don't see why women can't simply go. And see, even though it may, the cases may not get anywhere, but if it will tie up the Republican Party, then well and good. But I don't see why you can't simply go to the state civil rights office and file a complaint against them for discrimination.
Because Juanita, they are immune as a matter of law for anything that they do while in session.
So, but the party itself, the Republican Party, as a organization, as a political party, can you file a complaint against them?
It would have to be based upon specific conduct, not the general notion that they were somehow racist. There's a bit of a denouement to the story coming out of Texas. After they started it, the thing just blew up all over Twitter, and immediately well, not immediately, but it was eventually called off, the great tampon search of 2013 in Austin, Texas. An inquiry was made to the Texas State Police, and this comes from the Houston Chronicle. And rather than answer the question about what devious, horrifying purpose tampons could be put to, the Texas Department of Public Safety issued a statement. It read as follows, Juanita. The Texas Department of Public Safety today received information that individuals plan to use a variety of items or props to disrupt legislative proceedings at the Texas Capitol. Therefore, for safety purposes, DPS recommended to the State Preservation Board that all bags be inspected prior to allowing individuals to enter the Senate gallery, which the State Preservation Board authorized. Now, that's the Texas State Police's way of saying, it wasn't our idea. We're just following orders here. And then, during these inspections, DPS officers have thus far discovered one jar suspected to contain urine, 18 jars suspected to contain feces, and 3 bottles suspected to contain paint. Now, that's terrorist paint, man.
Mm-hmm.
All of these items, as well as significant quantities of feminine hygiene products, glitter, and confetti possessed by individuals, were required to be discarded. Otherwise, those individuals were denied entry into the gallery. In the interest of the safety and security of Texas legislators and the general public, these inspections will continue until the conclusion of Senate business.
Oh.
Is there anything that terrifies a right-wing male more than the workings of the female body, Juanita?
I don't think so.
I mean, and you know, it's not like, you know what? Interesting in that list of, you know, they found suspected urine, suspected feces, there's nothing in there about having found tons and tons and tons of recently discarded tampons having been put to their proper use.
Mm-hmm.
No, they are afraid, and holy mackerel, they are afraid of the very idea. You know, I mean, you know the concept of the Platonic ideal that there are things, you know, say, you know, ballpoint pen. And then there's the Platonic ideal of the ballpoint pen. They are afraid of the Platonic ideal of anything that reminds them of menstruation.
Yes.
I should probably use the echo function for that, but I didn't get it quite quickly enough.
Yes. That's exactly it.
Yeah, welcome to America.
Yeah. But I still don't get how they can do it without it being viewed. It is discriminatory because they are making laws against women because they're men, women.
Mm-hmm.
So it's discrimination because you're female. They're not making laws about men's reproduction. It's women.
No, and that trans anal ultrasound idea got shot down pretty quick. And it probably would have been a good idea for all of those guys. You know, I would hate for some, you know, like Lieutenant Governor Dewhurst to miss something like that and then wind up dying prematurely of prostate cancer. But
yes.
Oh well. But yeah, as being noted in the chat room, apparently, at least in Texas, the tampon is mightier than the 9mm Smith & Wesson semi-automatic pistol that'll hold 19
rounds. How about that?
You know, it's probably too much to explain to them, but, you know, Trayvon Martin was killed not with a tampon, but with a 9mm pistol.
Oh, yeah.
Really, feminine hygiene products are like garlic and silver bullets and mirrors and crosses and wooden stakes, all rolled into one for Texas Republicans because they're terrified.
Yeah, they are terrified.
They're very angry.
They're angry.
Well, anger often arises from fear.
And because they don't want to respect people that they have been taught since the beginning of their lives don't deserve respect. That women are not the same, as well as, you know, minority groups and so forth. And they are fighting, you know, to remain, to continue. To be the head honcho, you know.
Well, we've got another theory at work here, and it comes to us via Jenny in Wisconsin. She explains in an email. Let me get it here. Jenny explains, this is why Texas Republican men are so scared. It comes from Leviticus chapter 15, verses 19 to 33. And if a woman have an issue, and her issue in her flesh be blood, she shall be put apart 7 days, and whosoever toucheth her shall be unclean until the even. And everything that she lieth upon in her separation shall be unclean, and everything also that she sitteth upon shall be unclean, and whosoever toucheth her bed shall wash his clothes and bathe himself in water and be unclean until the even. And whosoever toucheth anything that she sat upon shall wash his clothes and bathe himself in water and be unclean until the even. And if it be on her bed or anything whereon she sitteth when he toucheth it, he shall be unclean until the even. And if any man lie with her at all and her flowers be upon him, he shall be unclean 7 days. Or, I'm sorry, I think that's a misprint. And her flows be upon him. He shall be unclean 7 days, and all the bed whereon he lieth shall be unclean. And if a woman have an issue of her blood many days out of the time of her separation, or if it run beyond the time of her separation, all the days of the issue of her uncleanness shall be as the days of her separation. She shall be unclean. And it goes on and on and on, talking about how filthy females are.
Oh, yes, I know.
Now you have to read that and remember that, for instance, Rand Paul, libertarian ophthalmologist, has a guy working for him who is a Christian Reconstructionist who believes that miserable 3,000-year-old bigotry,
yes,
should be the operative law of the United States of America.
Yes.
If that doesn't give you the cold chills, I don't know what won't, Juanita, or what will.
Yeah, it's shocking. I don't know why, you know, women are taking it, and I don't think they are.
Well, that's the thing. Women aren't taking it.
I don't think that is really, because I'm getting emails constantly. I mean, we had a protest here last week about, you know, what's going on here in Ohio with reproduction. And so, you know, it's just that we're not getting the kind of, really critical coverage, just the conversation that, you know, that you're having, you know.
Yeah.
And so, yeah. But if I can say just one other thing before.
Okay, I need to catch at least one more call, but go ahead.
Okay, let me say it real quick. Okay, about Snowden. He, of course, is, as you have said, and we all know, supported Ron Paul, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, Ron Paul, his greatest contributor, was a man by the name of Peter, I don't know how you pronounce it, T-H-I-E-L.
Field.
And he is the guy who used to own PayPal. And he's a right-wing Christian gay guy. Okay.
Wait, now, stop, huh? My brain can't process that. Right-wing Christian gay guy?
Yes.
I mean, I'm okay. And he's a right-wing Christian guy. How do you get to be a right-wing Christian gay guy? I mean, they're not going to let you in any of their churches.
Well, this guy is.
Well,
there's really no
substitute for the cleansing power of money.
Exactly. But he, guess what? He set up an organization called Palantir Technologies.
I know about
Palantir. Guess what that is?
Oh, yeah, I know.
And so I'm thinking, well, here you got Snowden, who's doing all this squawking about, you know, and his hero has taken all this money from this guy, you know, and the same thing with Greenwald. He almost, he nearly endorsed Ron Paul. And
that's why the focus in all of this is on the government and not on the corporations that are the problem.
You said it. You were the one who said it, that the conversation should be, you know, about these private, you know, these private guys. And so, I mean, it looks like Ron Paul wants to do away with the SEEEYEA, because when I say those letters, I was talking to a couple of friends, and my phone disconnected, Bob. Oh, I'm not kidding.
Oh, I know. There have been nights when I was going after AT&T that suddenly my connection to the stream has just gone and disappeared.
Yeah, I'm nobody. I'm.
Oh no, no, no! I'm the nobody.
Person.
Trust me.
But so he wants to get rid of that. But I guess he wants to give it to his privatized buddies, you know, which would be horrible.
We can always trust the private sector.
Of course.
Mm-hmm. Juanita, you have a lovely weekend. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Oh, you too. And tell Agnes, I hope she feels better.
I sure will. You take care.
Bye.
Bye now. Juanita calling from Ohio, and onward we go. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Big Bob. It's Mark down here in Tampa, Florida tonight.
Hey, Mark. What's happening?
Not much. I just want to take a drive tonight and get out of Central Florida, not for any particular reason.
Just sometimes it's good for one's mental health.
Right, and I would need constant attention in that regard. Being a 24-year-old rookie policeman in Miami, I for whatever reason I did develop an affinity or an interpretation. Actually being stationed at age 19 in Central America, you kind of get a feel for the crowd, or maybe like yourself growing up in West Virginia, you get a feel for the crowd, especially when you have a family that alerts you to pay attention to things. But, I was a class leader at the Metro Dade Police Academy because I was the former Marine and I was in good shape and looked like the all-American guy. But I would say most of the guys in my class were Caribbean. There were a few what I would call Yankees in there, Northeasterners, but there were, it was a mix, my academy class. And actually, some of the guys, they went on to other agencies. It was one academy class, but you may go to Miami Beach, you may go to Metro Dade, you may go to City Miami, or to the school department that had cops. And there are a few of the guys that I went through that, it's called BLE class, whatever it was, 64, that are dead, or some were killed rather quickly on the street or got themselves killed or went to prison. And one of the, just a quick experience that I would share with the listeners, I, as a rookie cop, we got a call to DuPont Plaza, which is still there, and a huge Hilton hotel, a party, in some hotel rooms, and I see my partners, just all, I'm not trying to be discriminatory. They were all Cuban Americans doing steroids. They were huge guys. I'm a big American guy, but they were bigger than me through the shoulders, especially after all the miles I'd done running in the Marine Corps. But I had the heart of a lion and a lot of courage and some mind, though it needs constant attention, Bob. But in any case, I thought, well, they're getting their riot batons out and their helmets, and they grabbed their vests. And I was like, well, what the hell call did they hear? So I guess it was kind of a constant profile that they didn't share with me, but I think I was the only Caucasian out of about six or eight cops. And everybody else was Cuban American, maybe one Puerto Rican American. In any case, we go up to this party and knock on the door, but I start seeing the crowd before I get to the rooms, and it's a predominantly Black American party. So I ride in the elevator like in the Blues Brothers with the music going, and I'm looking at the determination and attitude of my fellow policemen, same uniform. You know, we all look alike, and I thought, you know, I'm fresh out of the Corps. I know sports. I know brotherhood. I know devotion to duty, whatever you want to call it. And I thought, these guys, I'm not on the same team as these guys. These guys are going in to start trouble. We come off the elevator. It's a big hotel downtown. It's still there. And I noticed they didn't know exactly where to go. But for whatever reason, I think I knew quicker, just within seconds, to go a certain direction, and I look back at my partners again, like out of the Keystone Cut, but they were kind of zooming around, and they'd lost confidence, and then they were putting on their shit. And I said, you know, I'm taking charge. I might have been the rookie cop, the junior guy, to some degree. We're all quite under 5 years. And I said, you guys hold it right there. And I put my hand up to my fellow cops. I said, hold it right there. You guys stay right here. I took charge. I said, go over there. You stand over there. And these guys were, you know, I'm a 200-pound guy at that age, and I'm, you know, bigger than that now. But they were all bigger than that. They're like as big as pro athletes, some of them. And so I go to the hotel room. I said, I got this. And I go in there, and I handle the situation. It was a big crowd. But it was my ability to just have finesse and not a whole lot of hatred in my heart or soul. And people picked up on that, and I was accepted in, and I handled it diplomatically. I just left the diplomatic services and the call, and I established kind of a bona fides amongst my partners, though they continue to be more aggressive than that. But that, I'm not calling to complain about that. I would just say that I would just make a couple quick observations about the Trayvon thing, watching it here from an ex-Marine standpoint and ex-cop. The first policeman that responds to the scene is a 9-year veteran of the Marine Corps. He's a SWAT team member of Sanford, and apparently he immediately goes down and conducts CPR on Trayvon. And Zimmerman's walking around with his hand on his head in distress, and that's been confirmed by witness. And I don't know that it's been denied by the defense that was what somebody saw. And obviously it wasn't Trayvon walking around. So in any case, so he's upset. But apart from emotions, if you have a dedication to law enforcement, you would have conducted yourself, said, I committed a life-saving technique, and now I need to continue to save lives. Just like the argument people would make about abortion, you're against abortion, but any goddamn war that comes along, or if you're 2 years old and your parents don't get food stamps anymore, that's not really important. So Zimmerman meets the GOP profile on that, I suppose, unfortunately. The other standpoints from a tactical standpoint is Trayvon is allegedly beating Zimmerman's head on the sidewalk, though he's found quite a few feet away in the grass, which is, as you said earlier, well, I stand corrected, but somebody said earlier that they had seen the grass. I hadn't seen the photographs. I did hear you speak of the body photograph. I did not catch the one you described, Bob, but I did catch the one earlier this morning where they just showed a really quick glimpse of where Trayvon's face. And there was a comment, I don't know if yourself shared this, but it says apparently somebody in the jury was crying that was a right-wing talk show out of California tonight. I happened to catch a little cocksucker talking about that. But in any case, and how that may change something when people are not robots, and this isn't the goddamn army. And the dispatcher who gave the request, it says, are you following him? And his response was yes. And he said, we need you not to do that. It was a male's voice, regardless whether it's a male's voice. But the point is, dispatcher represents the police department. It's not an order. We are not in the Army. But it's, I would just share with listeners that dispatchers not only represent law enforcement when they make a request to the citizenry, and for you to disobey them could be at your own peril, but policemen actually work in many larger agencies' dispatch rooms, and they may actually handle calls sometimes if a dispatcher.
Well, yeah, when dispatch says we need you not to do that, it carries the same force and effect as when the dispatch says, one Adam 12, go to 314 Main and see the lady. It's no longer subject to discussion. Hey, Mark, I'm sorry I got to you so late. I got to get out of here. We're fresh out of time. But thanks a lot, and have a wonderful weekend. And hopefully, we'll talk soon.
All right. Have a good night, Bob.
Take care, Mark. Bye now.
All right.
A little policing insight from Mark. 1 minute to go in the program. Got to get out of here. We close the week in the red to the tune of $230. So 380 will be Monday night's fundraising goal. Hopefully that program will be coming to you live from AIC headquarters in Washington, D.C. Have a wonderful weekend, everybody. Skype group tonight after Malloy. Jump right in. The conversation's fine. Heck, maybe I might even wander in there. I'd like to. It's a great group. Thanks to everybody who makes all of this go. All our you first and foremost, our all volunteer staff. Thanks to Coal River Mountain Watch, and always, 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 Gina, Judy. It's all for you.